to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 547. I am your host, Jim McDowell, and joining me all the way from the East Coast, a little place called Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love, as it's known here in the U.S., Derek Cabrera.
What's up, guys? It's good to be back. Haven't been on a podcast for a little while, but I'm back, and we're going to be talking about some newsy stuff. We got some interviews coming up from the Phillip Island Classic, so that's going to be pretty cool, and me and Jim are going to dive into some Moto 2 and Moto 3 testing.
Yes, that's what we're going to do. I have also taken the time to record a second Jim's Quarter for all of you fans who are into the nerdy side of motorcycling. I'm not sure if it'll make this episode or if it'll be in 548. It depends on how many interviews we have left to go from Phillip Island and how long this show goes. Derek and I have first time we're doing one together, so we could be 20 minutes and we could be 2 hours. Who knows what's going to happen? But that's the fun, and that's why you guys all turn in and listen. And since you guys are listening, how it would be really great of you all to, if you get it from iTunes, to go over there, give us a like or rate the podcast there so that more people can become aware of the podcast. As Skylar said last episode, our whole goal is to do nothing but try to bring more people to the great sport of motorcycle road racing, and you guys can help us out with that by actually giving a good rating to the podcast. And the other way that you can help out is if you were to donate to the show. Every little bit helps. It's real easy. You can go to the new website that we have now, motopodcast.com, find the donate button on the left-hand side, and you can subscribe for as little as $2 a month. Every little bit helps to give us bandwidth and some place to store these podcasts and keep the website up and running. So with that, we shall get ourselves into the show. First of all, we got to put out a correction. Skylar knows needed to be corrected on his lack of BSB knowledge. So Craig Lowe and Dave Neal chimed in to tell us that GR Motorsport is the WD-40 team. Mason had rode for them last season in the Stock 1000 under the Stoff Connect Academy banner, the same yellow and green livery that Turin McKenzie won the BSB title under in 2016. Only the Superbike runs the WD-40 livery. One team, two liveries, which, as they've said, is always confusing. And Leon rode for the GB Moto a couple of years ago, and as the team disbanded, the main sponsor, JC SpeedFit, migrated to Bournemouth Kawasaki with him. So, for all of you fans who were disappointed in our lack of knowledge of BSB, well, we brought in the BSB guys to correct it all, and hopefully now everybody's going to be happy with that.
It's definitely tricky. I don't blame Skylar. I definitely get confused with all the BSB teams myself trying to get all the coverage here in the States. So we do apologize, but glad we got that corrected for you.
So we're going to move on to the second part here, which is the rapid fire question from social media. This week's topic that was put out on the Motopod fan page was the question, will Lorenzo get his Yamaha form back with Ducati this year? Derek, what do you think?
I do. I honestly think, at least from the first test, which, again, it's the first test, it's only a few days that we have, and there's more updates coming for Ducati. I think that's why it's so promising and why I think he will get back to maybe not his full form with Yamaha, but I definitely think he's going to win a few races. Not going to say he's going to be a title contender per se, but he's definitely going to push consistently at the front this year.
I'm of the opinion that he is back to form for his Yamaha form on the Ducati. I watched a little bit of the video from the test in Sepang, and the one thing that I always look at or try to concentrate on is how a rider looks on the motorcycle. And the way I saw Lorenzo was he was very much back to his Yamaha-esque style on the Ducati. He was definitely down under the bubble, had the elbow down, and he was very much on form, and he looked like a man who was comfortable with what he had. Of course, I agree with you in the fact that Ducati's always going to be chasing it. They're going to keep on trying different things and different pieces and trying to make it that much better. But I do believe Lorenzo is on form with the bike. I do think that he will be at the front or be a major player. And given how the season goes, we obviously know that consistency is a main point that we need to be on. And if he can maintain his consistency and pop in a win here and there on tracks that Ducati are definitely strong at, think of the Red Bull Ring in Austria. If they can be good there, win those when they need to, I think he can definitely be right there and giving Marquez and Vinales and Rossi a real run for their money with it.
Yeah, I think to your first point, he definitely looks more comfortable on the bike. From the footage that we have from the test, I think that's a huge point. I think the biggest thing for me, which, again, it's tricky. It's one test. We don't have a lot to go off of. But the main thing he seemed to struggle with last year is consistency towards the end of the race. He would burn up that tire. So learning how to manage that tire obviously has taken Dovi seasons upon seasons in understanding that bike. Ducati have a lot of things going on with tire management, but I think Lorenzo as a rider, that's going to be key for him. Not only the corner speed and having the feel from the bike, but also those little things in nuances that we're only going to see in a full race situation. So yeah, that's what I think. But yeah, let's hear what some of you guys thought.
Alexander Hastings says, "We will know more after the next test. He stated that they didn't really focus on long runs, and because of his fly and dive performance last year, I think it'll be easier to judge after he completes a long run, but his single lap was certainly impressive to say the least." Now, I have to agree with you very completely with that one, Alexander. We will know a lot more after the test. And when we get to the Thailand is this weekend. It's going to be one of those things where I think it's going to be a little hit or miss with that situation there. And I'm not so sure how much we're going to be able to really read into it. It's a brand new track for MotoGP. Nobody's been there before. So there's going to be that learning curve that's first going to happen where, times are going to drop drastically just as riders become familiar with the track and working with their machines at that track and trying to get a setup on there. But if Ducati does stay near the front, if Lorenzo stays near the front and can turn in consistently quick laps, then yes, they will be in on that one.
We got John Blow. He had a very well-worded answer. No. He decided to expand upon that a little bit. He said he'll improve, but not to that level, which is a shame because need more riders to challenge Marc Marquez. I think that's a fair opinion. I think being on one manufacturer for 8 to 9 years and knowing every little nook and cranny of that, to expect that to happen within 2 years at a new manufacturer, which is probably the hardest jump to go from a very neutral riding style of the Yamaha to a bike that needs to be ridden in a very specific way. So I think that's a fair point, but I disagree.
John, brevity is the soul of wit. I love that. No, just for that alone. I see where you're going with it, and I agree. But let me ask you this question, Derek. It kind of leads into what John was saying. I've ridden Japanese motorcycles. I've ridden the European motorcycles, and people say, "Well, there's a big difference between how a Japanese bike feels versus how a European bike feels." Do you agree with that statement? Do you have any knowledge to throw at that?
For sure. Yeah, I think, on a consumer level and, from what I've ridden from Hondas to Ducatis and Yamahas, I think there's definitely a different feel of the bike, a different characteristic. I think at the level and the technology that's being used in MotoGP today, especially with how paddocks are, everything is very similar in the technology and designs that are used to a degree. Obviously there are big changes within that. So I don't think it's necessarily to the level that we feel at the consumer level. And also you have to keep in mind, these riders are sensitive to a millimeter of change to a degree of that, the average rider, even pushing a street bike to the limit, typically won't feel. So I think while they do say, it's major changes from bike to bike, in reality, it's probably not that major. And they're only feeling that because they're pushing those machines to the absolute limit.
I agree that there's a very distinct different feel to it, especially at a consumer level. I've ridden a 996, and I've ridden an RC51, and I was lucky enough to ride them both back to back. To me, I felt like the Ducati steered like a truck. It's extremely slow. It's very hard to get it to tip in. You've got to use a lot of effort to go left to right with it. And when you get on an RC51, it's super easy. It just wants to roll over into the corner, holds its line, and it's definitely not hard to make in that transition. So I agree with you that, you know, these bikes are the top-notch technology that's out there. And, you know, this was obviously several years ago if it's a 996 and an RC51. But I do think that they do have different characteristics, and I think that each person has to learn how to ride the bike that has the characteristics that are presented to them. I think Iannone's kind of found that out with a Suzuki. I think Vinales has kind of found that out with a Yamaha. I think Rossi could tell you the same thing because, you know, he went from a Honda to a Yamaha to a Ducati and then has now come back to Yamaha. I think he would tell you the same thing. So definitely there is a difference that's there. I like Tony Poggs or Pags. I'm not sure how you pronounce your last name, Tony, but you say, I think he's very dangerous right now. The Ducati is better than ever, given how well everyone is doing on them, and he'll come into his own now. The pressure's off a bit since he had a fairly lackluster season last year, so expectations are a bit lower since there are more knowns. Spotlight is more on Andrea Dovizioso. Jorge is in the best possible position to clear off on that front.
You know what? I think Tony has an interesting statement that he had a fairly lackluster season last year. You know, I know Ducati is paying him a ton of money, and to a degree they expect results, but I think with the taste of the Rossi signing in 2011, 2012, and then you had Dovizioso come in 2013, just seeing those new riders and how they essentially either weren't able to adapt to the bike or, you know, how long they've taken to adapt to the bike, to really expect more than you got from Jorge last year. I don't know what other people were expecting. I think he met my expectations as a Ducati fan, as a fan in general. So I think from a performance perspective for what they're paying him, yeah, it was definitely lackluster. But I think that progression in that learning year is definitely what I was expecting. And I think next year, like he said, he's going to be very dangerous. So I'm looking forward to it. I'm excited.
I agree with Tony. I think he hit the nail on the head. The expectation is lower, and that kind of gives Lorenzo a little bit of cover that I think. He's right in the fact that there is more of a spotlight on Andrea Dovizioso. This is a guy who took Ducati to potentially their first world title since 2007 when Casey Stoner rode the bike, right? The unrideable bike that only Casey Stoner can seem to manage. And you're now seeing a bike that it appears as though almost anyone can ride it. Now, the question to me is this spotlight going to remain on Andrea? I think from the standpoint of Lorenzo, we know that he and Gigi Deligna have a relationship. They were together in 250s. They're very, from my understanding of the situation, those two are very, very close. And that's one of the reasons, as far as I can tell, that Lorenzo actually went to sign and ride with Ducati. Well, he went and signed and rode with Ducati. I think one of the reasons Gigi was there. I think number two is he wanted to get out from underneath of Rossi's shadow. And three, I'm quite sure Philip Morris put a lot of zeros on that paycheck. You know, so that part of it. But he has to, he's had a year of learning, and I think Jorge has to show that he is a contender with the bike. I don't think things, the Italian press always treat Ferrari and Formula One very differently than they treat any other Formula One team. I think they do the same with Ducati. I think there are expectations that are associated with Ducati and the Italian press, Italian media. And if Lorenzo doesn't meet up to them, I will guarantee you he's going to start to look bad to the Italian press. And I mean, he's got a hard shell and a hard skin, and it's going to be hard to get underneath of that. But I think he'll start to feel the pressure if he doesn't perform.
For sure. I think any rider is going to feel the pressure if they don't perform on the, one of the three major factories. You know, I think Jorge has, you know, he after the first test, he sees the light in front of him. He knows that the pressure's on. But again, I definitely think Ducati's up to the task this year. I think Lorenzo's up to the task this year. And yeah, I think we have said about as much as you can say about the Ducati right now. So let's move into some news, shall we?
Sure. Let's do that. So we'll start off with a bit of Isle of Man TT news. John McGuinness has signed to ride for Norton, which I think is very interesting. You know, John was a longtime rider on Honda. Hondas are now going to be piloted by Ian Hutchison and Lee Johnson. I think that's, you know, if you remember, if those of you who can remember back far enough, Ian Hutchison, sorry. Ian Hutchison won every race of the TT several years ago. Can't think of the year right now, but he did them all on a Honda. So is it going to be that homecoming that he's looking for? Maybe, maybe not. But the bigger news is McGuinness in my book. You know, he's quoted as saying that he didn't want to end his career due to an injury. He said he just didn't know whether he would be able to come back, and he didn't know how fit he was going to be. He says, right now, everything's going well. He says, I'm definitely ready for a change of manufacturer. I needed an injection of enthusiasm, and I found it with Norton. I think that's really the key of this, is that he needed a change. You know, John's 45. I don't think he has too many years left in him, and I think he needs that. The last few years he's been riding the TT, I think he's ridden lackluster, or you could see he was missing something. Like, I think he knew that he did not have the bike to ride against Michael Dunlop. And I think, you know, McGuinness, I think, sits one win away from tying Joey Dunlop for the all-time record and needs two. And I think that Norton could be capable with his guidance that if, you know, Dunlop or anybody stumbles, McGuinness is going to be right there at the end.
You know, I like this signing, but I don't like it at the same time. I think McGuinness needed a change of pace after the Honda. I think the Honda last year was a volatile bike to be on, regardless of who is riding it. There's definitely some mechanical kinks that need to work out, which we really saw through every single racing series, domestic, world championship level, like anything we saw. So that's a given. I think with his injury, to be on a bike with more expectations, I think would be pretty detrimental to McGuinness. To then, you know, I heard that at one point he was also in talks with Tyco BMW to get on one of their bikes. I think going on a proven race winning package like that, and then coming right off of injury, and then not performing, may be harder to swallow than going on to Norton, which really doesn't have any expectations whatsoever. You've had, you know, riders, you know, ride that bike around the mid to, you know, back of the pack. I'm using air quotes, like you can see me. But you know, there's tons of people who race the TT, but as a professional rider, again, the Norton's generally towards the back. So he doesn't have a lot of pressure on him. I think it's an exciting project. It's an exciting name. It's an exciting brand. So that's why I like it. I don't like it because, you know, I personally, you know, again, I'm not there. I'm not his doctor. I don't know how well that leg is healing up, but it seems to be a pretty massive injury. You know, he still had that cage on it. I don't know if he's gotten it off yet. And so
he doesn't have the fixator off yet. He gets that off in another month.
Exactly.
And he's going to be able to do this. So yeah, they were needing that fixator to grow back bone, as far as I understand that. I'm no doctor, but that's kind of what I read between the medical mumbo jumbo and big words that, you know, I got to go get a thesaurus out or a dictionary to understand what they're
for
talking
sure.
about.
For sure. Yeah. And I think for him to try to come back to any team at within, what is it? Less than, you know, 4 or 5 months we got. I think that's going to be really tough for him, regardless of the manufacturer. I'd personally like to see him take the year off, get fit, and come back with a race-winning team. He's John McGuinness. He's king of the course. Like, he's not going to not find a ride. So that's why I'm a little disappointed about it. I'd love to see him get fully fit, fully healthy, maybe take his fitness a little bit more seriously, but he's John McGinnis. That's why we love him. He's going to cook sausage at the back of the paddock and hand them out to people. So it is what it is, but we'll see how he does. Again, I think it's going to be a fan favorite with the brand, with the man himself. But yeah, we'll see how he does.
Yep. I think the biggest factor for John is the fact it's a British brand with a British rider.
For sure.
I think that's the allure. Cause he was talking about the,
there's a lot of prestige. Yeah.
Yeah. Norton's won there long, long ago. They won there with the rotary engined bike in like 94. Maybe. I know you ILTT guys are screaming right now, Jim, what the heck are you thinking about? But it was this year. But it's a classic concept. It's a very British thing. And I think he wants that one time. I liken it to Rossi wanting to ride for Ducati because he is an Italian wanting to ride an Italian bike.
Yeah.
And I think John's sort of in the same boat.
To a degree.
What better way for John to finish off his career, maybe ride one or two more years at the TT with the Norton and, you know, call it a career. And I don't think anybody's going to criticize him for that.
Yeah. You know, I think that's a swang song approach. I think he would rather do the Joey Dunlop where he comes back his final year, wins the senior. But you know, I don't think this is going to be the last manufacturer for McGinnis. I don't think this is going to be where he ends it. I think he's really going to try to win because that's what he does and that's what he knows. And I think that feeling of finishing where the Norton is most likely going to finish is going to be tough for him to swallow. That's my predictions. We'll see how this goes out in another 2 to 3 years. Like you said, he is 45. I think it's going to be very tough for him to give up racing as it is for any racer. But yeah, we'll see.
I would much rather have John McGinnis being part of the ITV team and doing color and talking about the track and talking about what riders feel on the bike. I would very much want him to be able to do that and be a part of that, because I think John, with how he sees things and how he kind of gives it to you real and doesn't sugarcoat anything, would be fantastic in that booth.
I think that's one of the appeals about the TT is that, you know, you have these riders, they're straight, they're not trying to please some press officer, especially McGinnis with his insights and the way he talks to the crowd. I think, you know, he really does that well. But at the end of the day, he's a racer. So if we're actually going to see him on TV, I'd be very surprised, but we'll see. Well, it's going to take some time.
All right. Well, let's move on to what we're really here for, MotoGP news. Little bits are out there. Randy Mamola will be inducted into the World Championship Hall of Fame, or the Legends category, if you will. Those of you who don't know, Mamola came to the series when it was on 500s in 79. He finished runner-up, I think, 5 times in the championship. So it's good to see, and Randy has always been in the paddock. Even once he was done racing, he's always been in the paddock. I believe he does something with Alpinstars. Is that correct, Eric? I think he's guy.
You know, he's had a number of roles throughout the paddock. He had a big role in getting riders for health to be a thing and a charity that the paddock really supported. He's been rider coaches for Bradley Smith. He did the 2-up rides for Ducati. So he's been around. He's done everything in the paddock. You know, as a racer, just going through the history books, watching old film, like you see Randy Mamola, he was essentially the Danny Pedrosa of his day, always the bridesmaid, but never the bride. So I think, putting him in the Hall of Fame, I'm surprised this didn't happen earlier. Honestly, when I heard about the announcement, I was like, he's not already in there. But yeah, it's a very cool thing to see. And, looking forward to, did they end up announcing what race or when he'll actually be inducted?
I believe it will be at COTA.
Okay. Very cool.
So we will all be able to be there to witness it, which should be fun. And of course, it'll probably be some private ceremony held back somewhere where we aren't going to be able to get close, which I think is a shame. But that's what I know of it right now.
Very cool.
And as I pointed out, on Twitter when the news broke, he is the original Samurai of Slide. There was nobody better at sliding a motorcycle or lighting the back end up than Randy Mamola was. That's for sure.
I think there's great footage and really great representation of who Randy Mamola was. If you guys haven't already seen the Unridables series of documentaries, really documenting the late 80s, early 90s, golden age of racing, even though we are now currently in the golden age of racing. Definitely
does that
good
make
documentaries.
It the silver age?
We'll see. I'm not the naming convention expert. It's we got two golden ages. How about that?
Okay. All right. A little correction on my part here. I had it down that Yanni Hernandez was the man with the plan and the seat at Tech 3. That appears to not be the case now. Hafe Sairen, as Skyler pointed out to us last week, is going to test the M1 Tech 3 Yamaha in Thailand. So is that a revolving door right now? Is it Hernandez? Is it Sairen? Who is it going to be? Or is Dorna going to come in and say, well, at these three races, it's going to be Hernandez. At these so-and-so races, it's going to be Sairen. And then somewhere else, it's going to be somebody else on the motorcycle. I'm not sure. But
yeah,
what we know right now,
I don't think Dorna is going to have their hand in the teams like that. To a degree, I think Hervé made pretty clear whoever was going to test the bike at Sepang was not going to be the official rider. He said that in a couple outlets. So to hear Sairen, he gave up his seat, and the team announced that Carradine will take his place. That seems pretty official. So this looks like his seat to lose. I think everything is there for him. He has the backing. He has the sponsorship. He's a Malaysian rider. Dorna is going to love that. It's probably the biggest market for motorcycles and MotoGP right now. So unless he really screws up the next tests, it's really his seat to have.
I can't disagree with it. I think some of his Moto2 rides have been pretty good this year. He did seem to come on very strong towards the latter part of the year. His races, sorry guys, you can probably hear my dog barking in the background on that one. Somebody's coming to the door. It's probably my daughter coming home. Anyway, he had some great rides there at the end of the season last year. His rain riding ability was really good. He had some strong outings in the rain. I'd be interested to see what he does on the M1 in Thailand. And, you know, it could be good enough, you know. The question I got is, you know, is Gi Kyu Lam looking at it, and is he, you know, whispering in Hervé's ear, you know, who's better at sorting out a motorcycle, who's not? I wonder how much say Gi has in all of this.
I think Hervé's, you know, very good at spotting talent and you know, talking to the riders. He seems like a very personable guy. But I mean, look at his signing with Folger last year. No one thought Folger was going to do anything. He was very hit or miss within Moto3 and Moto2. Obviously now it can kind of be traced back to an illness, his up and down possibly. But even with that said, Hervé has a very good eye for talent. And I think taking that risk on Sairen, I think Hervé knows what's up. So again, as a fan, I'm really excited to see that. I think Hafe Sairen seems like the nicest guy you'd ever want to meet. So from that perspective, I'm really excited to see him on the bike, and hopefully he doesn't do anything to screw it up too bad.
No, I hope he doesn't either. I think he's a, you know, from what I've seen of him, personable guy. I think he tries really hard, and you know, hey, this is your opportunity. So you know what, reach out with both hands, grab hold, and don't let go.
For sure, for sure. And moving on with the latest news that was out a little bit earlier today is that Pol Espargaró is going to be out of the Buriram test in Thailand, having been diagnosed with a hernia in his fourth lumbar vertebrae. I believe this stems from from his pretty gnarly crash that he had on in Sepang on the second day. So hopefully he gets well soon. KTM aren't going to be without Mika Kallio, though, so they'll definitely get their testing program in, hopefully not be too far behind the other manufacturers when we head to Thailand later this year.
All right. So let's talk a little bit of the testing that has happened between now and then. Of course, the MotoGP test in Thailand is happening. We got 2 days, I think, before it starts. So today's Tuesday. So I think it starts on Thursday, runs Thursday, Friday, Saturday this week, and we'll talk more about that. We are going to talk about Moto 2 and Moto 3 testing. They have tested in Valencia, and they tested in or are testing in Jerez. I think there's one more day going on there. Then Moto 2, if we look back sort of at the final day from Valencia, just kind of run down kind of the top 10 and who was there. Pacini, then Baldassari, Simone Corse, Oliveira, Isaac Vinales, Hector Barbera, and Marcel Schroeder, and Xavier Vergne. I knew Skyler told me how to pronounce this one, but this one I cannot get. And then Fanati was ninth, and Binder was 10th. So it looks like Kalex is sort of the bike to be on right there. KTM looked pretty good with Oliveira in there. And Fabio Quartararo had the first speed up. So it's going to be interesting. As of note, Joel Roberts was 13th on the NTS bike. So good for him.
Yeah, I think those times are not the most representative just due to the weather conditions, as well as it was everyone's first shakedown at the start of the year. And keep in mind, not everyone was there at Valencia. I think these, you know, the new times coming out at Jerez, again, it's just testing. So we have to take a lot of that with a grain of salt. There's not a whole lot that comes out from the intermediate and lightweight classes in terms of news as there is with the MotoGP tests. So, you know, it's a little bit tricky. I think some of the times in Jerez, you know, it's kind of no huge surprises. You know, definitely people that you think are going to be up there: Bagnaia, Pacini, Marquez, Lowe's, Baldassari, Binder. I think Xavi Vieji on the Calix this year, as opposed to the Tech 3, he's definitely a name that I'm really interested in and how he gets on. Kind of a name that's been up at the top of the timesheets that I've been a little bit more surprised than I probably should be is Baldassari. He's always fast. He's always quick. I think the big thing with him is he can stay on the bike this year. Throughout a lot of last year, he made some crashes. I'm going to be very impressed to see Baldassari, and I hope he can stay up front because, again, he's now with the Pons team, really one of the best teams on in the paddock in Moto 2. So I'm excited to see that.
Yeah, there's a lot going on there. A lot of moving parts, as they say, things are going there. Let's break it down this way. I thought that Fanati has done very well in his move up as a rookie to the class in Moto 2. I think he's gone about it from what I can see from the times and what little bit of news that there is, as you said, is that he's getting acclimated to it. He's getting on with the bike, and I think he's trying to find, you know, his baseline and trying to figure out how to really ride that bike. I do think that if we get a rain race somewhere, Fanati will probably win it, or at least at the very least be on the podium for that. The other guy who I thought as a rookie who is doing quite well, Juan Mir, your Moto 3 champion from last year, of course, he seems to have found his groove, at least from the Jerez test. You know, he was 10th quickest as of the end of time today. We'll see what happens there tomorrow. But has anybody else really jumped off the page at you as a rookie, Derek?
As a rookie, you know, I think those are the two biggest names to take a look at is Juan Mir and Fanati. Mir, I think, is as an intellectual rider, is really, especially compared to Fanati, he does has a lot of emotion. He's very, you know, to see if he gels with a team, I think is going to be a huge thing as well. So all things to take a look at. It, you know, he's stepping up with the team that he was on. So that should give him some consistency, but I think really all eyes are on Mir. You know, just down from the racecraft that he showed us in Moto 3 and understanding what it takes. Now he's really in the most competitive class in the world from top to bottom. So to see how he navigates that by the end of the season, probably by the middle of the season, we'll see him on podiums, if not sooner. So that's where I'm excited to look at.
You know, I think one of the things that I thought was interesting here is that when you, from the Jerez test, was the fact that Brad Binder was faster than Miguel Oliveira on the KTMs. KTM, I think, will do quite well this year. I am pegging Oliveira for the championship. I think he's got what it takes. I think that the team is gelling with that KTM, and I think that they can win the championship. I think that what they found last year in the last few races was something special. I think they've got it sort of set up, figured out, ready to go. I think this is definitely the time that they need to step up and win, because this is the last year with the pseudo Honda motors, because Triumph comes in next year, I believe, with that with their motor, with their three cylinders. So that's going to shake things up big time when we get to that point. But who do you look at as the favorite to win the championship?
You know, I wish I had a different answer than you, but I'm going to agree. I think Oliveira, he's my pick for the championship, not only down to his form at the end of last year, but down to the rider he is. He's very calculated. He's very calm. I think testing times with a rider like Oliveira, they're not everything. They're not everything to look at. I feel like he parallels very well to Dovi. In that he's a thinking man's, racer, and he thinks of the big picture. At least that's the vibe you get from him in the interviews, from how he presents himself. So I think he's my pick. Granted that the KTM keeps up with the development, it's much easier for Kalix to develop the bike just because of the number of riders on it. Last year, you had two riders on the KTM. Now, I think we're going to have four or six riders, but they just need to make sure that continues to grow with their riders. I think Binder's going to make a much larger push towards the front, but I think Oliveira's main rival is going to be Marquez and is going to be Benyaya. Pacini's going to mix it up with them as well, and if he can start as the beginning of the year that he had the rest of the middle to end of last year, that's going to be interesting to watch as well. But I just have a feeling the consistency won't be quite there compared to Marquez, what he showed, and Benyaya, the glimpses that we had of him last year. I think the main thing, and obviously every racing class is consistency, but yeah, I have that feeling about Oliveira too, and he's definitely my pick.
So you're actually saying Marquez is going to be a challenger for the title?
For sure. If you asked me this at the beginning of last year, I'd say no. I'd say he's not going to stay on the bike. He's going to crash too much. He's not going to make a push for it. But I think this year, he's definitely learned a lot. He had some performances last year that were very impressive. And his consistency, he's not a crasher on a Moto 2 bike anymore. He's going to be there. He's won a championship before. He understands what that takes. So yeah, I think Marquez is going to be up there challenging for the title as well. Definitely.
Interesting. I'm not so sure. I would love to see it. Don't get me wrong. I just don't know if he's got the consistency.
Who do you think will be Oliveira's main challenger then?
I think it's gonna be Baldessari, and I think
really,
I think Baldessari's got something to prove. I feel like he has something to prove, and I think that's like his motivation in that one.
I agree. I just don't think again through what we saw last season, and very well, you know, not necessarily all of it's going to come down to the team, but I think the performances were just not there consistently, and I think he's crashed too much. So unless he can really improve that, I don't think Baldessari is going to be a true challenger. I think he's definitely fast enough to be a challenger, but is he going to be fast enough to consistently be a challenger? That's my real question. I think a huge name also that we've completely overlooked so far is Sam Lowes. Everyone's putting a lot of pressure on Lowes. There's a lot of expectation. He's on the KTM as well. In my heart of hearts, I would love to see Sam battle. But I think there's a huge question mark over that. And I don't know. I honestly don't know if he's going to provide that.
Yeah. I think if we're looking for someone to actually challenge Oliveira, I would go with Bender, because Bender's got the same bike. And Bender was definitely as fast as Oliveira was at the end of last season. Definitely looks like he felt good on the bike. So, you know, I do not think Oliveira is going to run away with this title.
Oh, definitely not.
What I think is going to happen is different people are going to step up at different points of the year and are going to present themselves as contenders, but then they're going to fall off. That's how I see it. I think at the beginning of the year, I think Marquez is going to have a strong start to the season. And I think he's going to have a middle section where he's going to just dip. And that inconsistency part is going to let Oliveira kind of get away. I think Baldessari is going to have a slow, have like a kind of a decent start to the beginning of the year. But I don't think he's really going to come on until the end of the year. And by then, I think it's going to be too late, because I think Oliveira is going to have a point lead that's not going to be necessarily insurmountable, but he's going to ride it out just sort of kind of like Morbidelli did last year. So who knows? We could all be completely wrong. Somebody will point that out to us later
for
on.
Sure. That's for sure. Yeah, if we listen to this back at the end of the season, we're probably all going to look like idiots. But
I'm okay with that. I'm an idiot every day.
That's the whole fun of trying to figure out racing. You know, you never really know. There's so many factors. But yeah, it's. I think Moto2, as always, it's going to be the closest class. It's going to be the toughest to call. Moto3, I would like to say on the other hand, but really on the same hand, a very tough class to call. We've had some interesting tests. I think it's very interesting to see Bastianini at the top of the timesheets so far in the past few days at Jerez. You know, with the year that he's had last year, to see him up at the top of the timesheets is really interesting. And again, it's just going to be about consistency with Moto3. I've been doing a lot of thinking about Moto3. It's going to come down to consistency, racecraft, and really teamwork. I think the last 3 years with Kent, with Binder, with Juan Mir, those have been the three main pillars. So, no one that is in the field currently stands out to me as having all of those three things. Probably the closest in my mind is Jorge Martin, and he finally won a race last year. So, you know, hopefully he can continue that. And I think he's going to really be pushing at the front of the field, because everyone else just hasn't shown that consistency yet. But with Moto3, the riders are always developing. They're always showing more and more. So again, it's very hard to call, as is Moto2. So
I think this is the most wide open of all the championships, and definitely the hardest one to call at this point, because it is just testing. If I had to put money on anything, I'd put money on Martin to win the title. He was consistent last year, just somehow he couldn't figure out how to beat Juan Mir. But then again, nobody really could.
Exactly.
Mir is one of those sort of like the next generation of alien, if you will. This one, you can look at the Valencia times and you see like Olivia Loy is like 15th, but you go to Jerez and Olivia Loy is almost at the top. You know, he's fifth. So where do you put that? How do you look at that and say, well, who's going where and who's made a jump who's made that leap, who's found whatever it is that they need to go in there. But, you know, I don't know. This one's just so, so hard. But I do think,
And again, there's only so much information that we have, as opposed to being in the paddock, asking questions, to seeing what the teams are doing. I think that's a lot of those nuances in figuring out what they're testing, and how they're going about a testing program is huge. And, one fast time throughout the day, though Bastianini has over a pretty significant margin to his next closest competitor, while it is impressive, it's not the ultimate be all and end all, especially in such a close class like this, where it just comes down to racecraft. After 17, 18, 20 laps of being an inch away from first place, it's understanding how to get yourself there at the last lap, which Mir did better than anyone, which Binder did better than anyone, which Kent did better than anyone the years they won the championship. So it's impossible to tell you who's going to do that from just a timesheet at the beginning of the preseason. But if we had to put some money on it, I think Martin is the clear favorite, just down to his experience thus far and the consistency that he showed last year. It's just a matter of if he can continue to stay healthy. I think that's been his biggest thing.
Mm-hmm. I will agree with you on all points there. You couldn't have done better. I couldn't have said it better myself, but I do think it's going to be like Martin, Bastianini are going to be probably the two dominant riders, possibly. somebody else could who knows, you might see three races in and you've got somebody else who's going to be just completely come out of the blue.
Where did this kid come from?
He came from the CV, right?
Yeah. So I think Dennis Foggia is going to be one to watch out for, but
yes.
Again, if we kind of go in line with our CEV champions the past few years, we have Buliga, we have Quartararo. They didn't make the impressions like we thought they would. I think Foggia going into the Sky team, there's going to be pressure on him. All eyes are on him. It's going to be very interesting to see what he does, but I don't think, just kind of based on the track record of what the CEV's produced within the last few years, with the champion, there's been other riders to watch that have come through. So I think Canet, again, very dangerous. It's going to be about consistency with him. I think Migno, he showed a lot of performance last year. And Della Porta on the Leopard machine. Huge talent on the Mahindra last year. We really didn't see anything. And that's a very hard bike to show on, unless you're Pecco. So, I think Moto3 is going to be wide open. Excited to see some racing, because again, it's really hard to call otherwise. But unless you have any other insights on Moto3, I think it kind of wraps up.
Yeah, the only other thing I was going to throw out there is I think Ramirez may shine.
Oh yeah,
there were flashes of it. He was looking very good at the final race of Valencia. The old saying is you're only as ever good as your last race. Well, he was looking spectacular.
For sure. I think Ramirez and Binder both showed huge promise. And now Binder going to the IO team as well. Both of those guys, I think they have potential to run up front, but to mount a championship challenge, again, it's going to come down to consistency. I don't know if either of them have them. So we'll see.
And that's why we can't wait for the season to start, right? So we can figure out how wrong we actually are.
Exactly.
Or how brilliant we are. But I'm betting that we're not going to be brilliant.
I think that's fair.
And with that, I think we pretty much covered about everything that's happened this past week. So I want you guys out there to know that you can get to leave us some feedback. Tell us what you like. Tell us what you don't like. Did you like the rapid fire? Do you not like the rapid fire? Do you like Jim's Corner? Do you not like Jim's Corner? Do you like this or that? Let us know. And the way you can do that is by going to emailing us at Motopod at motopodcast.com. Be sure to check our Twitter feed, which is at Motopod, but it's MOTO_POD. We're trying to keep a lot more news current and let people know when episodes are out via Twitter from all there. You can always reach me on Twitter at MotoRGV, also Instagram at MotoRGV. Derek, where can they find you?
And everybody, I've streamlined the process of finding me on social media. You can find me both on Twitter and on Instagram at MotoDerekC.
Okay, there you go, guys. Of course, if you had anybody else you want to talk to, you can always reach out to Skyler at SkylerV28 on Instagram and Twitter. You can find Andrew Course on Twitter at Andy_Course. And then again, you got some part-timers out there. Dave Neal loves to talk BSB, so hit him up on Twitter at Dave Neal or Instagram at the Dave Neal. Martin Darlington will talk motorcycles anytime you want, so hit him up at Motopod Martin. Lynn Padilla can be found at MotoLynn. You want to talk some Moto A or Moto America, you need to talk to Scott Bolton, and you can hit him at MotoDog650. And of course, our friend Statman Harry Lloyd is at HLComms on Twitter and Instagram at HLPhotographyGP. So that is going to do it for Derek and myself's part of this show. Please stay tuned because you will hear Phil Hall doing some excellent interviews from the Phillip Island Classic. It will be amazing, I guarantee you. I've heard the first ones. They were fabulous. You definitely want to stick around and hear those interviews. Phil Hall does such an amazing, amazing job getting those interviews. I think his style of interview is amazing. It's great. I love what Phil does for us. And provided on the length of the show, there will be a Jim's Corner either in this episode or the next one. That's all I have to say. Derek, anything to add?
Cheers, guys. Have a good one.
See you guys in a couple of weeks.
Okay, well, this is Phil Hall reporting for Motopod from the 25th International Island Classic at Phillip Island in Australia. And a pleasure to welcome to the microphone Jason Pridmore from Team USA. Jason, welcome to Phillip Island. Welcome to Australia.
Thank you.
Question first and most important question is, are you having fun?
Oh my gosh, this place is amazing. The only thing that makes me sad about it is that I'm not younger and I can't, you know, I wish I had come here many, many years ago, but the experience so far is, the track's my favorite I've ever been on, and the people here are truly amazing, and Phillip Island itself, the little island, is, I can't believe I don't hear more about it. I've heard, obviously we all know where Phillip Island is, but just the whole, everything about the place is amazing to me. Yeah, it's great.
Jason, you're a second generation racer.
Yep.
And from where?
From just from California, from Southern California. My parents immigrated from London in the 60s, so I was actually born in California, and then my father went on and won 3 Superbike championships in America, and I think he came over and did, he came over and did Bathurst back in the day. So I've had ties a little bit with wanting to get over to Australia for many years, but it's just the opportunity never really came upon me the right way, and the Phillip Island Classic is something I've known about for 8 or 9 years as well through Steve Martin. My friend Steve Martin raced World Endurance with me, so I used to always hear about this event, so I've always wanted to be here, but yeah, I remember my dad coming here 30 or 40 years ago.
Well, it's funny because I photographed that meeting in Bathurst. I've got photographs of your dad.
That's awesome.
In Bathurst, that would have been 78, I think.
I think you're right, yeah. He was Superbike champion when he came over, so yeah, I think it was probably 78, yeah.
Now, I started riding in 74, and I started going to the races in 1976. From about 74 through to the late 70s, I bought every motorcycle magazine that you could buy. There was no internet back then, of course. So my staple diet was Cycle Guide, Cycle World, yes. Street Bike, you know, all of those great magazines, which unfortunately now have all passed into history with the advent of the internet.
Yep.
But I remember all those magazines, and I'd, you know, watch your dad on the Butler and Smith BMW number 163, and him and Steve McLaughlin,
yeah.
and Cook Nielsen on the
Cook Nielsen on the Ducati,
and those guys were heroes back then. And you think yourself, winning a Superbike championship on a BMW.
Yeah. No, my dad was a pioneer for Superbike, which is amazing. And, you know, I idolized my dad, obviously, as a kid. Wanted to be just like him, and he gave me a lot of opportunities to do what I'm doing now. And he definitely created a path for me to be successful in my life as far as motorcycles go. But you think about the guys you just mentioned, Steve McLaughlin. I remember Gary Fisher back on the BMW with them. Cook Nielsen was almost a second dad to me. I remember Phil Schilling. I remember a lot of the same people that you mentioned there. And it was a great time in my life. And I still remember, I get certain smells and thoughts of back then. You know, I go to certain tracks, I'll be like, oh, I remember that from wherever. But yeah, it's been pretty amazing to... Like you said, the internet's taken over so much, but those magazines back then had a major feel to them, and that's where we used to get all our information. Yeah.
So you were a racer's kid. You went to the races with your dad?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, I was wrapped in it from day one, and I was just like you. I was a little younger, but I was definitely reading all the magazines, and I was doing all the same things, and, you know, I think I just grew up around it so much. Even when I started school, my dad never forced me into racing at all, like at all. But when he started doing his motorcycle schools after he was done racing, it was a kind of a pathway for me to be able to still go to the racetrack. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been there. And so I realized, you know, how much I loved riding motorcycles. And I've just been lucky throughout my whole life to go travel the world racing. It's been great.
So what pays the bills, Jason?
Right now, I do a lot of teaching in America. I'm doing a lot of I do a lot of one-on-one coaching, kind of all over America a little, and then I'm also working for BN Sports, doing all the color commentary and things for the Moto America Championship, and that's been a lot of fun for me because that series gave me so much life when I was a racer, and you know through the economic downfalls and things that we've gone through worldwide, you know I've seen that series go from everybody wanted to be there. You know we had Matt Mladen, we had Troy Corser, we had all these guys come over. And then I saw it to where it dwindled away. And I think now with Wayne and all the rest of the people from Moto America, it's our series is back surging again a little bit, hopefully. And, you know, they're going into their third year, and I'm hoping that it just continues to grow.
Well, it was very sad to see. And, you know, again, on the other side of the ocean, I followed the AMA, of course, particularly because Matt Mladen was so successful over there as an Aussie, you know, and I followed him. And then DMG took over, and I thought to myself, you know, this is not going to be good. You know, the signs were never good right from the start. In fact, I wrote an article in my blog that was titled DMG plus AMA equals OMG.
Yeah. And you know what? You're so right. DMG really ruined the face of road racing in America. The people that were making the decisions there were trying to think outside the box, but they went to another level with it, and it really destroyed our series, honestly. The fact that we've got some people now that have experience and they're trying to get it back on its feet again is good. We're starting to see more people wanting to come from other countries again back over to America. The big thing for me is, you know, I was lucky enough to race motorcycles when people could make a paycheck, you know, or the riders. I want to see it get back to that. I feel so disheartened for all these kids that are coming racing and they have to bring 100 grand with them or more to go racing. Sometimes the best talent we have don't ever get to see the racetrack anymore, and that's sad to me. So we've got to figure out a way to get the OEMs more involved in America. They're involved all over the world except for America. I think that we need to get people OEM-wise in America that are interested in racing, because right now with a lot of the big companies over there, they don't even know what Moto America is. There's a lot of people that don't even ride motorcycles that are making some of the big decisions. And, you know, racing might not be what it was where race on Sunday, sell on Monday, but it can still be influential. We got live TV now. Wayne and everybody from Motor America's coming and try to repair the series. It'd be nice to see a few more of the OEMs jump on and try to help those guys as well, you know?
Well, I guess, and through social media, these young riders that are coming up are starting to get some exposure. I'm sort of following a few of those because they're the children of friends, Facebook friends of mine, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm watching how they're going. This young Ryan Deutschlander,
mm-hmm.
young bloke.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Looks very, very impressive.
Yep.
But you know, when you think the career path that he's going to have to get onto is going to be so much more difficult than it was.
The thing that's sad to me is you bring 100,000 or more to a team and you win a championship, what do you got? You got 100,000 gone, you got a number one plate, now you got to raise another 100,000 to do it all over again. And to me, it's, you know, I don't have all the answers, but I'd like to see that somehow get changed. But I think it's really going to start with OEMs getting back involved a little bit, helping some people along, maybe creating some sort of contingency programs again, figuring out a way to start reviving our sport bike world again. And you know, and we have a lot of kids in America in the KTM 390 Cup Championship that are phenomenal riders, but it's where do they go after that? What paths do they have to choose? Getting some of our kids over here to race in the World Championships again. It's great that Jake Gagne is over here. It's great that PJ Jacobson's over here. You know, people like James Rispoli, he was outside the box himself. He's like, I got to get to England. I got to get somewhere because our series was so down in the dumps at the point. There was, even if you were winning, it didn't matter. So you got to go someplace where if you're winning, it matters. And then if we can make it to where you, when you win in America, it matters still again, that would be great.
And hopefully another generation of Robertses and Lawsons and Rainies.
Yeah.
Mammalers and those guys who we talk about in reverential terms now as well. We should.
Yeah.
But, you know, that was 20 years ago.
Yeah, it's 20, 30 years more. You know, it's every year it ticks by and it's just another year forgotten. And I think that, you know, we have to be able to create a path, and it's great to see so many Europeans dirt tracking, you know, over the last 10 years. It just seems like more and more dirt track has gotten so big with the Super Prestigio in Spain and all that kind of thing. That's those guys from 20, 30, 40 years ago created that for everybody. And the Europeans learned how to dirt track and do all that kind of thing. Now with electronics and stuff, it's not the same dynamic as far as riders go. I don't think that you have to slide bikes and things as much as you probably did back in, you know, 10, 20, 30 years ago. But there are great riders all over the world now, and I just love to be able to see U.S. have some more kids racing in the World Championships and go on from there.
Oh, absolutely, no question about it. And yeah, the pattern of how to do it is there in Europe, and the Europeans have done it right, but they're reaping the benefit of what they've done for the last 10 years, and you can't create that overnight. You have to make that happen gradually.
Yep.
And you look at it and you think, well, payoff's going to be in 10 years, but, you know, we want some payoff now.
Right.
But it doesn't work like that.
No, I think that a lot of us, you know, when Nikki went to World Superbike and then we lost Colin out of MotoGP, there was a big sigh in America of like, man, it's finally hit us all that we really don't have anybody behind them. And, you know, we were all pulling for Nikki to do well in World Superbike. He just didn't have the equipment. And then we lost Nikki, you know. So it's been a sad bit of time over there for us. And I think Jake Gagne is an amazing personality, and he's a good guy. He's a great rider. I hope he gets the real shot over there, even though we know he's stacked against him. I think it's incredible that Honda's given him a chance. PJ Jacobson's the same way. Work ethic's incredible. But I agree with you that America in itself, we raised the bar when all the Lawsons and the Rainies and all them came over. Everybody over here learned, and then now we've got to start over again. America's got to start over and get some people over here.
So, Island Classic, Jason, why?
It's a good question.
Or should I say why not?
You know, I've always wanted to come to Phillip Island. There's been a lot of Australians that have kind of come in and out of my life that have influenced me a lot to want to get here just to come see the place. Matt Mladen being one of them. He was a great friend of mine. I had a lot of respect for him as a writer, as a person. And then really, when I started doing World Endurance, I was meeting more and more guys that were doing this event. So Steve Martin, John McGinnis, some of my friends, Cameron Donald. I started meeting more of these guys, and they would tell me about the Phillip Island Classic and how I've got to get over, and I really wanted to get over. But it kind of seemed like the time had passed and it wasn't going to happen. And then this year, I was in Spain. I really have Jeremy McWilliams to thank for me being here, if I'm being honest. I was in Spain for the World Superbike round. The KTM 390 Cup kids from America came over to do that race. And I said to Jeremy, I go, oh, you know, I know Phillip Island's coming up. Man, I would love to do it. He got me in touch with Pat Mooney, who's done this event before. One thing led to another, and I ended up, Ralph Hudson was kind enough to say, here, take my bike. And if it wasn't for that little chain of great people that got me here, I would have never thought about it. And what that's truly turned into is I've got an entourage of people here with me. I got 16 people. We've all come over from America. We all did track days here on Monday, Tuesday. So we had our own garage. We were with the Phillip Island track days guys, and they gave us our own garage. We had our bikes. And we just had two amazing days. I could have, honestly, Phillip Island Classic's the reason I'm here, but those 2 days were great. I was with all my friends. And then this year, it just worked out perfect because it's ironic that Courser's here, which I think is incredible. And then Colin coming here, I thought when Colin signed on, I'm like, something's got to be going on over there to be that good. And when I talked to him, he's like, Jay, you won't believe the circuit. And truly, this place is unlike anywhere I've been. I've been lucky enough to race all over the world. This place is special, you know. And from the time I got here, the people are incredible. The island's incredible. And the racetrack, you just can't, I can't say enough for it. It is so much fun. Every time I go out, I look at that view leaving pit lane, and I'm like, wow, I can't believe I'm, looks like I'm in a park, you know. It's great. Really great.
I've never heard, I've interviewed dozens and dozens of people, plus talked to hundreds. I've never, ever heard one person say, Phillip Island is good, but...
The cafeteria is great. Everything's good. The coffee's good. You know what I'm saying? You're 100% right. Everything about Phillip Island is special. And this will be, to the day I die, this will be a place that I'll come every year now. Hopefully I can do the classic for as long as I'm capable. But I still ride a fair bit, which is nice. I'm on a motorcycle a lot at home, so I'm not too rusty. And so far, practice today has gone really well, really fun. And hopefully I can, this has motivated me to make sure that I keep up on it through the year so that I can come back to Phillip Island for years to come.
It's funny you should mention Pat Mooney, of course, because there is a sort of a connection there, because Pat's an expatriate Englishman,
yep.
Like your dad was.
Yes, he is, and he was amazing to talk to. I spoke with him, and then Dave Crissell, our team owner, he's English.
An expatriate Englishman.
Yeah, and I'm thinking we got all these English guys on the American team. But I think even that, there's already been talk. You know, I'd love to get Josh Hayes over here, or Steve Rapp, or there's been some names thrown around of how we can make our team a little bit better in years to come. And I would love to be a part of that. You know, this year I got Jake Zemke with me, and Colin, obviously. Barrett Long is here. He's been here before. But it's a matter of us getting on the right equipment, because I think this race, we all come here for fun, but... Of course, we're all racers, and everybody, nobody wants to finish 20th, right?
Of course they don't.
And so with that said, I think that we could probably entice a few more of the boys from over home to come over and see this incredible country and incredible circuit.
Well, it's interesting because years ago, I think probably the first year that I came here, Gary Fisher was the captain of this American team, and I sat in the car with him, and I said, you know, I said, Gary, I said, you know, you've got a team of really enthusiastic amateur riders,
yeah,
who are getting taken to the cleaners here,
yep,
by these guys.
Yeah.
I said, what can you do about it? He said, I know what I can do.
Yeah.
He said, what I've got to do is I've got to get one marquee name rider who is interested in coming out here and racing. He said, when I do that, he said, the floodgates will open.
I agree. And I think that this might be the year where we get that started. You know, there's a lot of enthusiastic people in our garage that have set kind of the standard for us. So they've opened the doors for us to be able to have a U.S. team. All of them are such enthusiastic guys, you know. But now it's, I think, as they get a little bit older and as we get some of the younger guys from America that maybe aren't racing anymore or as much, but they're still out there, I think that we have the basis to run a really fun, great team. But it's like everything else. It's funding. It's getting the money to be able to put it together to get everybody over here. I came over here because I had 16 friends that wanted to come and ride, and I thought, I haven't been on a holiday in a long time, and this just was seemed like the right time. But that said, even in our team briefing yesterday, it was brought up that, hey, Colin's here, Jake's here, and, you know, unfortunately I'm here, and that might be a good start to a pathway that could lead on to getting some more people over here as well. I think it's, as a rider, I'll tell you this, though, anybody that doesn't come to Phillip Island, I don't care where you've raced, who you are, if you don't come to Phillip Island, you've done yourself an incredible disservice. Even if you have to pay your way to get here, the place is incredible. You got to come see it. It's unlike anywhere else.
And what's it like? I make no secret of the fact that I'm a dyed-in-the-wool Ralph Hudson fan. I think, you know, Ralph Hudson is one of my all-time heroes.
Yeah.
You know, what's it like to work with Ralphie?
Ralph's amazing. You know, when this whole thing came together with Pat saying, hey, gee, there's Ralph Hudson. He's got a great bike. What really worked out was he only was 40 minutes from my house. That was great. And so I wasn't going to just call him and say, hey, this is who I am. I want to take your bike. You know, I couldn't do that. So I called him, kind of got a feel out of what he was like. And he had already talked to a few people about me, which was kind. And so I took him to dinner. And I left with a motorcycle that night. And Ralph's an incredible guy, 66 years old. He went to Bolivia last year, went 289 mile an hour. Went to the FIM Awards banquet with Mark Marquez 2 months ago and got his medal. He's an incredible individual. He's got some great stories. He tells them without a hint of an ego. And the fact that he let me use his bike. And there's a few people there, too. Benny Solis Sr., he went through my bike. Like he probably put 30 hours into the thing to make sure that when we got here, it was going to be okay. There's some people that you really have to thank, but it all started with Ralph. If it wasn't for him lending me the motorcycle to come over, I would have never been able to come here.
Oh, so it was very cool. He said when he was at the FIM dinner with Mark Marquez, he was sitting with Mark Marquez, and he said it wasn't really very polite for me to say it. He said, but I'm faster than him.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. Well, definitely in his form of what he does. And when you hear the story of there sort of being 10 people out in the middle of this area in Bolivia and there's nobody else there and it's getting to sort of 25 degrees at night, it's just freezing cold, and they're all there for one purpose. And, you know, it's got to be a little bit of an eerie thing, I would think, being the guy that's riding out there and nobody out there but you. But he's done some incredible work with the bikes he's had. And we've done some updates for him on this bike, and I think he loves it. It's great. And he's in the garage today. You know, he's got his hands in it and getting dirty, and it's incredible.
So, Jason, can I take it that if the opportunity was offered for you to come back to Phillip Island again, you'd say yes, definitely?
No question. Yeah, I mean, I don't care if you could sort me out like a good world superbike, or at this point, I don't even care if it's a sidecar. As long as I'm back over here and I get to go around this place, you know, maybe I'll get Colin. Colin and I can come do a sidecar or something. That would be great. But yeah, no, all kidding aside, this will definitely be a yearly pilgrimage for me, and coming down here and doing some riding, and hopefully I'll still get a chance to do this race because I love it. It's great.
Jason, thank you so much for talking to me. Yep. And talking to me. And I hope you have a great weekend. I know you're going to have a great weekend anyway. Yep. So, but it's really cool to talk to you. Your dad is still around. He would be retired now. Yep. Probably be similar age to me, I guess.
I really wish he could have come and seen this race because I think it would have been neat. I've seen a lot of bikes that are from his, you know, when he won Superbike Championships. So, but yeah, no, thank you so much. I'll definitely be back for sure.
Sure. Well, give your dad my regards and tell him that I have admired him for a long, long time.
Yep.
And you know, it's great to talk to his son, and it's great to talk to you. I just, you know, it's a real buzz, and you know, you can tell that I sort of rather like this as well.
Yeah, no, I appreciate
this. Is it a job for me? This is a passion.
Nah,
it is for you.
Well, thank you for helping keeping our industry alive, because we need guys like you to keep getting the word out there on so many things. So I appreciate that very much as well.
Jason Pridmore, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, we're here at Phillip Island for the 25th International Island Classic, and I'm talking to Bruce Lynn from Team USA. Bruce, welcome to Phillip Island, your first visit here, and you have some interesting stories that I want to hear, and you have an interesting bike that I'd be interested to hear you talk about as well, so welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. I've watched Phillip Island for probably 30 years on the telly, and always wanted to be here, and this has been my first opportunity as part of Team USA.
So, Bruce, where do you come from?
A little town north of Seattle, Washington, USA, a little town called Snohomish. Oh, it's an old timber town, but now it's antiques.
And it snows there?
About every other year we'll get a snowfall in town. But 60 miles away, we've got mountains that they ski on every year.
And Bruce, how did you get into racing?
In 1962, my father was an airline pilot, and all of the other pilot family, we would go camping, and they all built what was called tote goats back in that day, which is a balloon tire with a Briggs and Stratton 5-horsepower 4-stroke motor on them. Well, I begged my father to build one because, so that I could ride around the campgrounds like all the other kids were doing, but he refused to do that. So in November of 62, he said, we're going to go look at this motorcycle shop because I've just seen in Japan a Honda 55 trail bike that I want for hunting deer. And so he bought that bike, and within 6 months, I turned it into a English Scrambles bike. And went ahead and competed with the local kids in non-sanctioned races. And then in 1964, I was working at a motorcycle shop, a Honda dealer, and owned a a Honda Superhawk 305 and heard about a road race that was going to happen in June outside of Seattle at a place called Pacific Raceways. So I had my very first race in June of 64, and I unfortunately had used some Webco brand alloy tappet nuts that stripped out. So like a lot of people, I DNF'd my first race.
Yeah.
But then I got hooked. I've been doing it for 55 years since then.
Wow.
Not consecutively, because I had to take a break being in the Army for the U.S. government. And then one year I got hurt really bad at Laguna Seca and took another 18 months off. Other than that, it's been solid all the time.
And racing mainly on the West Coast, or have you traveled further afield as well?
Because of expenses, it's been predominantly on the West Coast. Especially in the early years, we would we'd go do Daytona at the beginning of the year because it was a solid week. And I'd get a week of practice in before the local guys had even turned a wheel. So I'd come back for the local events and be ready to go, and they were just coming up to speed. And then when they started Laguna in 72, I was at the very first Laguna and watched Cal Rayburn lead with a Harley-Davidson coming out of Rainy Corner. It wasn't called that then. We had some other tracks that they used. Riverside ran for a few years. And I would do club
Ontario.
Races. Ontario. I did Ontario for till it closed. I would go down and do club races at Sears Point. We did Vacaville, which no longer exists. That's by the Air Force Base there. And then... So I did solo racing from 1964 until 1980, and then I actually drove sidecars for 6 years in the United States and also New Zealand and Canada. And we had a TZ750-powered Windle rig that had been highly modified by the gentleman who also made the modifications for my TZ750 that's here this weekend. We virtually won every race that we didn't blow up or spin out in the rain in 6 years. We started, there were 50 sidecar teams in the United States and Canada. When we stopped at the end of 86, there was four teams that were traveling the circuit. They didn't want to get beat anymore. It wasn't fun anymore. So then I went back to solo racing and did contingency racing from 87 until 91. First with the Honda Hurricanes. Honda in the U.S. was paying $1,500 for a win, and the bike cost $4,000. So I paid for the bike many times over. And then the next year was Suzuki Katana. Contingency was the way to go, so we had one of those. And then Yamaha for a couple of years. But my love was always on GP bikes, and both my parents passed away in 92, and with the inheritance, I was able to go buy a brand new 1993 TZ250. And I've been on 250s pretty much since then, and in 93 through 2001, I started doing the full U.S. national circuit, and... In 2001, I got hurt really bad in Laguna Seca, the bike, and I went off the racetrack at 80 miles an hour, and it went up in the air on a high side, and it came down on top of me, and more injuries than I want to let people know about, and I retired for 18 months and sold everything.
As you do.
And then the AMA announced in 2003 that they were doing away with the 250 GP class. And I rode the first one called that in the AMA. I damn well was going to ride the last one. So I got my wife to acquiesce and let me go ride the last event, which is at Barber Motorsports Park. First time the AMA ran at Barber, by the way. And then in the meantime, I actually gathered enough spare parts again and built a bike. So in 2004, I now have a bike and no national series to run in.
No class to run in, yeah.
And... Fortunately, secondary organization that had been had taken over the 125 GP class when the AMA dropped that about 5 years earlier, picked up the 250s, and that was the U.S. GPRU. So again, I wound up in 2003 going out and doing a national series around the United States for the 250 GP bikes. So the and that's what I've ridden right up until this last year. My first ride since 1983 on a TZ750 is this weekend.
On a bike that you have owned for over 30 years.
Yeah, it's it sat in the back of my my garage, my workshop, unused since 1983. And when it was suggested that I participate as part of Team USA, I went out and looked at it and looked at the very narrow period of tires and wheels that were on that 1975 motorcycle. We're talking 3-inch wide rear rim. And the rear tire width was smaller than the front tire of my late model V-twin 250.
Yep.
And plus 17-inch and radials on the newer bikes versus the bias ply. So I immediately started checking around and determined that what the majority of people had been doing was modifying the older bikes if they were going to ride them, other than the period 5 stuff, and put 2005 R6 swing arm and suspension on the bike along with wheels. And so I started that, and it became a major undertaking for my fabricator, Richard Washer of Wasco Frame Service in the Seattle area, to widen the swing arm pivot by 2 inches and then make the chassis not look like a Morphidite kind of thing. It looks, if you were here to see the bike, it looks like it's OEM. And I got to ride the bike yesterday, but had some mechanical problems, so never finished the session. So my first full sessions were in qualifying today. I'm not up to the speed I would like to be, but I came here knowing it was going to be a challenge, and I'm just glad to be riding Phillip Island.
Absolutely. And your impressions of the track obviously will be the same as most people's impressions of the track. You go, wide eyes, you know, why have I missed out on this all this time?
The flowing nature of this facility and how high speed it is challenging, because you've got to commit yourself to every single corner to the max, or you're going to leave too much on the table. And that's not something you just do. So obviously, the Aussie riders who have been riding here for a long time have a big advantage over those of us that have never seen the facility before. I just wished I'd gotten in the 4 sessions yesterday so I would have had a few more laps. But again, I just wish we had something like this in the United States. There's nothing like this on our continent.
Apart from the big meeting at Barber.
But it's still not like this. Barber is more point and shoot, whereas this is the high-speed flowing circuit. Barber was designed more as a 250 racetrack and is too short. Everybody that rides there says if they just made it a half mile longer, it would be a perfect racetrack.
So it doesn't have the long, constant radius flowing corners like we have here in PR?
No, it does not.
Modern design circuit. TZ750, and incidentally, Bruce, I'm tickled to death to hear you calling it a TZ750. That really gets me. That's very, very cool. What's the history of that bike?
It was originally purchased by a Canadian gentleman by the name of Frank Johan, and he raced it in Canada and in a few U.S. events. And then, like so many people of the time, because this bike originated as a twin shock, and they weren't very good handling motorcycles, because the two rear shock absorbers would oscillate back and forth and basically put the bike into a speed wobble.
That's right.
Especially on the banking at Daytona. They would become almost unrideable. And Frank was a Honda car dealer early on as well, so he pretty much lost interest in riding the bike. Although his last event that I know of, he actually came down for the to New Zealand for, I think it was the Marlboro Series back in the 70s.
Yes, the Marlboro Series.
And he He actually had a rod fail, and like usual with these four-cylinder motorcycles, it damaged the crankcase, and they tried to weld it using oxyacetylene and didn't get a good weld, so the crankcase didn't seal at the base gasket, which, again, was a common problem back in those days. And so he sold the bike to a mate of mine who had been on 250s, and he raced it locally in club races for about a half a year. But it scared him so bad that he'd stop breathing and hold his breath, and he'd almost pass out on the bike. So there again, he stopped riding it. So when I started driving the sidecar, we wanted to have a spare motor because I was riding the solo TZ750 and doing the sidecar with a TZ750 motor. So we took borrowed the motor from the whole bike from my mate and carried that spare motor. And then he lost interest in it as well, so I acquired it. And so it's just been sitting since 83. Another friend of mine rode it in Daytona in 83, and that was the last time it was used.
Of course, the early model TZ750s did have a very evil reputation, didn't they?
Again, that was primarily due to the handling, not because of the performance, because in reality, they only had about 130 horsepower.
That's right.
But the problem really was the tire technology wasn't up to the 130 horsepower. So we were pushing the limits. And back then, the tires would chunk about every other year at Daytona, too. So once they went to the monoshock version, the bikes would handle. For a while, the AMA made us go ahead and put restrictor plates in the carburetors to have no more than a 23-millimeter opening instead of the 34 or 36-millimeter carburetors that guys were running on them. And that, again, was to try to keep the tires from exploding, like happened to Barry Sheen in Daytona.
Daytona in 75. Yes.
Right.
That's right.
So then they became extremely easy to ride because they had so much torque and they weren't as violent. Almost took the fun out of riding them because they were too easy.
And if you look at them now, give yourself, really speaking, it's still a very modern concept and a very modern design that came out 40 years ago.
Yeah, actually, most people don't know this, but Yamaha displayed a four-cylinder, two-stroke street bike at the Tokyo Motor Show in 1973 called a GL750.
That's right.
And that actually was the pre-runner to the TZ750 race bike. When Cal Carruthers went over in late 73 to test the prototype race bike, it still had a piston port motor and prior to them putting reed bells on it, and it was so violent and hit so hard that Cal Carruthers said he wouldn't let anybody ride it. The Yamaha had to tone it down. So they used their motocross technology and put the reed bells on a road race motor, which was the first time.
That's right, yes. And of course, back then, reed valves on a road racing bike was unheard of. It was all piston port stuff, wasn't it?
It was, and they were concerned that the reed valves wouldn't last, so they actually made them out of steel. And they did break, and when they broke, they destroyed the engine.
Oh, because they would straight into the inlet port and just wrap them around inside.
And they'd wind up damaging the ring, the piston, or the whole cylinder itself. So it wasn't until later, on later model bikes, that they actually went to the plastic reeds, and when they break, they don't do damage.
Boyesen
actually made them, and Yamaha on the later production bikes actually has a plastic kind of it's not really a plastic, it's more of a fiberglass.
So, getting back on that bike now, what does it feel like after not having ridden it for 30 years?
Well, because it's got the 17-inch radial tires and the wide wheels, the R6 has a 5.5-inch rear wheel, and I think it's a 3.5 or 3.75 front. and the radial tires, it feels a lot like my 250, just a little stronger on acceleration. The weight is 100 pounds more. The 250 weighs 240. Draw weight with water and just a little bit of gas on my TZ is 340. So it's a little more effort to make it go around corners. But other than that, it just feels like it feels like you would like a good 250 to feel. So it just it does everything just a little faster.
What sort of speed? I mean, you won't know, of course, because they don't have a speedo on them. But what sort of speed do you reckon you're getting over the top of the hill here, just under the bridge at Fort?
Well, the fortunately, the timing loop actually gives us our top speed,
right.
And my machine right now, I've got it. We're running avgas instead of the 110 octane NASCAR gas we would run in America, which isn't available here. And avgas burns a little slower than the other stuff does. And also, I'm running very rich on jetting for longevity because I've never run avgas before, so it's a little unused to it. So
never lean out of two-stroke.
Well, certainly not where. In the old days, you would be within one main jet. I no longer take those kind of risks. At 70 years of age, I'm doing it for fun, not because I'm trying to prove anything to anybody.
Because you don't have to.
Yeah, including myself. I don't have to prove anything to myself. So right now, the bike should be revving to 10.5 or 11, and it's only revving to 9.5. And that's just because it's too rich and not really the proper maximum setup. But even at that, it's doing 180K.
Wow. Over the top of the hill.
Yep.
Yeah. And is it like sort of meeting an old friend again?
Actually, it is. Not having ridden a 750 for two-stroke, I rode thousands in the 90s, Yamaha 1000, FZR 1000s, that were all hopped up and lightened, and that was much more violent than riding this bike. It's just fun to be on an old friend.
And Bruce, apart from all this, what else are you doing? Retired, obviously.
Well,
enjoying your retirement?
I retired for the second time last January. I spent 36 years at the Boeing Commercial Airplane Company as a developmental program manager for complex systems on new airplanes. Worked on 747-400 before it flew, worked on the 777 airplane for 10 years, and then worked on the 787 Dreamliner for over a decade. And retired in 2010 for 18 months before they suckered me to go back to work for them because they needed the skill code.
I was going to say, they found you were irreplaceable.
Well, I was one of the few that they could convince to come back in because they'd let so many people go.
Mm-hmm.
And then I worked for another 5 years till my wife was able to go on the socialized medicine plan, which in the United States, if you have private medical, you can't really afford it. It's over $1,000 a month. So she turned 65 in January. Probably shouldn't let people know that because if she hears it, she'll be upset I'm saying her age. But that allowed both of us to be on the what they call Medicare. So January 8th of last year, I retired, and I'm really enjoying it. It certainly allowed me to go ahead and take the time off necessary to come down here and spend 12 days on tour prior to the event, spend the week here, and enjoying ourselves.
Okay, that's really cool. Now, you've got a family?
No, no kids. We've got four-legged kids.
Four-legged kids. Ah,
yep.
Fur babies.
Yes, we have Dane people, Great Danes.
Ah, right. Okay, I bet they keep you busy, too.
They do, and our retired champion boy is 37 inches at the shoulder, and he's light at 170 pounds.
Oh!
We've had 200-pounders.
So he could bowl you over in the yard if he wanted to.
If he runs right straight at you and doesn't veer at the last second and hits your knee, he'll blow your knee out.
So you've been touring here as well and seeing the country?
when we decided that I was going to race, my wife insisted that we go ahead and spend some time prior to the event. So I went online and found a very excellent tour at a reasonable price, and we did 12 days. Spent 3 days in Sydney doing the touristy things. Then we went up to Ayers Rock and spent 2 days up there and saw the sunset and the sunrise at Uluru.
As you must.
And then we went to Kings Canyon and walked back up there. That was rewarding. Did 3 days in Cairns, and then another 3 days in Melbourne. And then now we're at Phillip Island. Then we go home right after the event and get ready for deciding what the schedule will be for this season.
So tell me, is the TZ going to go back in the garage for another 30 years?
I doubt that.
Yeah, me too.
the problem I'm going to have is I can go to the modern bike series with my 250. The 2000 model or my 98 V-twin, and they don't really have a place for the 750. The vintage class is primarily for four strokes, and most of the TZ 750s go to another series that's called Arma, and that's fine, but they only run a open two-stroke, so I could only take one bike. So I'm not sure I want to stop riding the 250 yet. And, of course, the 750 being twice as many parts is going to be twice as expensive. And the 750 will use up tires that much quicker. So on my retirement income, I'm going to have to decide how many and which events I want to go to.
So you're going to have to be a bit more selective. But, you know, I'm getting the vibe here that bike is going to be kept and looked after until Island Classic next year. Oh, come on.
I'm not going to commit, but
yes, you are. Come on.
But I would say it's highly likely that we will be back next year.
Bruce, thank you so much for your time. And I wanted to talk to you because I just had this idea that there was a great story there, and I was right. Thank you so much for spending the time talking to MotoPod. Our listeners are going to be absolutely fascinated, mate. Thank you so much.
Thank you as well.
All right, it's the Island Classic, 25th International Island Classic from the beautiful and, I have to say, punishingly hot Phillip Island Grand Prix circuit here in Melbourne. And as I always try to do with Island Classic interviews, I always like to at least do one interview of someone who most of our readers haven't heard, and I'm going to do that right now because I've got sitting with me here Dennis Curtis, and for some of you that will be a familiar name, but probably for most of you it won't. So Dennis Curtis, welcome to MotoPod, and tell me, why is Dennis Curtis a name that we probably should know about but we really don't?
Well, thank you for asking me to talk a little bit about what we do in Canada. We build racing chassis. We don't build complete bikes, but we build racing chassis for classic racing motorcycles from the 60s through to the early 90s. And the reason I'm here, and I want to get that clear right away, the reason I'm here in Australia is we have built quite a number of chassis for the Team USA, for Team New Zealand, and several for Team US, for the Team Australia, and Team USA and Team New Zealand saw fit to entice me to come over with a ticket and some accommodation. And so my wife and I said, well, we always wanted to come to this fabulous country, Australia, and to visit New Zealand. And so that's why we're here. We're here for the race, and then 3 weeks in Australia, and then 3 weeks in New Zealand. But why should people know about what we're doing? Well, the top three American riders who have been really doing well here, considering it's their first visit, and some of the bikes haven't been as prepped to the level that Team UK bikes are prepped, are here and equaling the lap times, by and large, that Jeremy Williams and some of the faster Team UK guys are. So we're building a replica of a Harris chassis, but it's an updated replica because the specifications of the frame allow us to use larger diameter forks, 43 millimeter diameter forks, and 5.5 inch rear wheels and 3.5 fronts. So we can use those big superbike slicks, MotoGP slicks, that are extremely sticky. And with being able to use those slicks, we have to use the geometry that allows them to work in the heat range. People don't understand that, but it's the tires that are the key issue on a bike, a race bike, particularly in these temperatures. We try and keep the heat in the front tire. And so the designs that we're copying from the 80s, in this particular case, in the International Challenge, needed to be upgraded so that we could use those slick tires. You could tell me that, well, the Australians are only allowed to use 4.5-inch wheels, and the Americans are allowed to 5.5-inch wheels, but that's politics, and I don't get involved with that. But suffice to say, the bikes are working the way we've built them, because we're already equaling the times that Team UK, and they're the main competitors here. So our job is to redesign the frame and then build it a little stiffer than it had been built in the past, because these tires and the new suspension and better brakes are putting additional torsional twisting forces on those frames. Stresses, yes. And so when a former world champion, former superbike champion twice, Colin Edwards, when Jason Pridmore, 2 times world endurance champion, and Jake Zemke, who's won Daytona, modern bikes, and has been AMA champion in the USA, get on these bikes, they expect to be riding something similar to what they got off of when they retired, or are still riding. So we've tried to emulate that geometry in the new chassis. So do you say, is that legal? Should it be allowed this way? Well, everybody else is doing it. It fits the regulations. And to be absolutely candid, the original fairings, so there are lots of copies of, available in both the UK, in the USA, and here in Australia and New Zealand, fit on these chassis once they're built. So they look like the originals. They have the original engines, tweaked probably a little more than they were in the day, but they now handle. And we're getting around in 137 twos, and I think with the potential that we've seen here this weekend, with these new riders coming in who have formerly retired from really prestigious careers, we feel that we could get the legs of the Team UK in the year next year or the year after with our frame kits. So it's become quite the popular frame for people around the world who are in classic racing. We don't advertise. We have a website, CMR Racing Products, and we have a Facebook page off the main page of that website, and we have a blog that keeps customers updated. And we're here with these particular frames. The Team UK don't have any of our frames, but Team US have, I think, about 13 or 14 now, a combination of TZ750, XR69, and F1 frames. Team New Zealand have a similar amount, but they're not all being not been ready for this event. They're building their team for next year, for 2019. And then, of course, we have Marty Craggle, who was in Team Australia, but they're developing their TZ750, and as you just heard, he's got a first place in Forgotten Era, the premier class, with 2 firsts and 2 seconds. And I think he was backing off in that last race to save his engine. It was 2 firsts, a 2nd, and a 3rd, wasn't it?
I don't know that they've got that big a budget for tyres either.
Yeah, that's
so he was probably saving the rear.
He probably was. You're absolutely right, yeah. So, to cut a long story short, we build these frames and 22 others. Building frames right back to the 60s. And we have a small shop in Trenton, Ontario, not far from where I live. I used to build frames in the 60s in the UK. I learned my craft as I was taking engineering apprenticeship. And back in those days, we had a 5-year engineering apprenticeship, and you had to go to college 1 day a week, and that same college 2 nights a week. So it was a lot of studying. We didn't get paid a whole hell of a lot. So we went from riding bicycles to work to motorcycles to work, and of course the next stage was racing motorcycles on the road and getting on tracks to be more safe. And I was lucky to get to know a fellow who was building sidecar grass track racing bikes for his son, who was a friend in the same apprenticeship program that I was. And Mick Ingemels, who's long since passed away, was a local champion in Lincolnshire, where I come from. And his father was itching to show somebody else, teach somebody else those skills. And because I always hung around their pit in the various grass track races around our fair Lincolnshire, I said to Mick's dad, I said, if you want somebody to learn your trade, I'll put in all the time I possibly can over and above my apprenticeship. And he taught me the wherewithal of how frames are designed, how to build them, and I served my craft well, because pretty soon I was building my own race bikes for Vincent Engines. And then when I came to graduate from my apprenticeship, I emigrated to Canada and fortunately landed in Vancouver, where I was offered a job with the Dealey organization. At that time it was Dealey Yamaha, the Yamaha dealer for all of Canada, and Trevor Dealey was my mentor. He found out that I used to build frames and used to race, and he provided with me with some race bikes to race in local races. But the important thing that a lot of people don't realize, that Trevor said, I want you to help me with the Yamaha Motor Canada to improve the motorcycles that my riders are racing on. Steve Baker was one of them, and Jimmy Dunn was another, and there's a fellow here with Team UK whose name just eludes me right now, who used to race at the same time at Westwood Racetrack in British Columbia, where I used to race. And as a result of Trevor insisting that I start doing work for them on a contract basis, I started building frames full time and made quite a mark for myself then. And then fast forward, after I sold that business, working with Honda in their new distribution center in Vancouver for all of Canada for their motorcycles, cars, and outboard motors, I then got into the automotive industry for a while, and in the late 1990s decided I was going to go vintage racing again on an RZ, RZ350, and a TZ350G. And not soon after starting, somebody touched my back wheel and I high-sided and broke my back. And my wife, bless her heart, who had agreed for me to start racing again, said, well, if you ever consider getting on a motorcycle again, and then brought the surgeon in and showed me the plate in my back and the x-rays and the screws into my backbone, she said, well, why don't you start building frames again, you know? And so I said, I'll try it for a hobby. Then my brother-in-law walked in and said, well, we should put you on a website. I hadn't used websites back in the 70s. They didn't exist. So with the advent of putting a few photographs from the 70s, I started to get a few inquiries, and not soon after that, this hobby business turned into a full-time business. I have one full-time employee that's been with me for now 9 years. I've taught him everything I know about frame building, and he is a master welder. That's why I hired him. And Byron Cox is with me now. He's here in spirit. We call each other every day. He's now building some more F1 chassis while I'm away for 7 weeks. They're all sold, and we're picking up orders now as I walk around the pits from several people who will remain nameless, and for TZ chassis. So I didn't come in here with the intention of selling anything, but our name is well respected here. I've had so many people walk up and say, we've looked at your chassis and they're incredible, and then hearing from Jason Pridmore saying it's one of the best handling chassis he's ever ridden. Now, from Jason Pridmore, that is praise indeed.
Indeed.
And going out on a bike that he really hasn't raced on this track before, a strange bike that he's only had a few test laps in California before he left, I'm totally impressed with the way those guys performed on the bikes, and it tells me that we're doing something right.
Absolutely, no question about it. I mean, he's jumping out of his skin. I mean, the motor's let go now, but you know, he's more than proved his point, hasn't he?
That's it. That's exactly where I'm coming from. Jason and Colin Edwards, who rode a very similar bike to Jason, and we would have liked to see him, you know, on the podium as we would have Jason. And in fact, Colin's bike wasn't really ready to come to Australia. The person who owns the frame had been working on it, but ran into a few problems, not with the chassis, but with the engine and with a few other things. And of course, Colin got onto it, and even though it wasn't sorted, did a 137.4. Basically, he and Jason were equal. So we're very happy.
That's what a former, you know, two times world superbike champion can do.
Can do, yeah.
and of course, I just want to get back to the TZ350F in a moment, but just the importance of having highly rated riders on your frames is incredible, because basically they're doing R&D for you.
That's exactly the point. The team captain of Team USA, Dave Crustle, has been coming to one of our local tracks in Ontario, Canada, Mossport. Everybody knows Mossport. It's a fabulous track.
Yeah.
But he would make the trail over from San Francisco, California, where he lives, to race at Mossport. In the old days, you used to race Mid-Ohio, which was a really great run event, until Armour ran into some difficulties and it no longer exists, but he still comes up. And Dave bought one of my TZ750s to compete at the Isle of Man in the new Classic TT, which started in 2013, I believe. And first time out with only four laps on the island. And Dave had ridden the island, but not really fast. First time out on the island, he managed second place in his class and averaged 107.33. He still has it written on the tail section. The bike that's just sitting in front of us here.
Yeah. I don't think it will ever be erased. And if he gets a new tail section, he'll put that sticker back on the new tail section.
Yeah, he certainly will. Well, Dave started this whole thing with Team USA because I knew Dave back in the day as a Kawasaki rider. He rode H2Rs and H1Rs and A7Rs.
Have you seen his lounge room?
I've never been to his house, no.
Oh, you should see his lounge room.
Yeah.
He's got 17 Kawasaki's in his lounge room.
Yeah.
And all really important ones, like factory prototype ones, and ones where there was only two or three of them. And I said to Dave once, several Island Classics ago, I said, "So, Dave," I said, "you're a Kawasaki man." I said, "What's with all this Yamaha stuff?" And he looked at me straight in the eye and he said, "Well," he said, "the TZ750 is the bike that Kawasaki would have built if they could have."
There you go. Very diplomatic. But Dave's the consummate enthusiast, as you well know, with all those bikes he has. And he's so very generous with telling people about what we do. I've actually repaired some works frames that he's found in Canada that have been broken up and used as drag bikes. But he's managed to find these bikes with all the parts that were cut off. And in one particular case, we refurbished an H1R works bike that Canadian Yvon Duhamel had ridden. And he had it, he had the logs and all the information that this frame had been ridden by Duhamel, and it was recognized by Kawasaki. And what we did is we put all the pieces together from photographs of how the bike looked. And David sent us a whole bunch of dimensions. We sent it back to him, and he said it was perfect because he had an original swing arm. This thing didn't have a swing arm. So we like doing that, but I prefer in our business to be building the very latest specification of road race bike.
You can warranty, because you know everything that's gone into it. It's nice to repair something, particularly something that has provenance and has historical significance. But in the end, there must still be that doubt in the back of your mind of, I've done this, but I wonder what else has been done to that before I got it.
Well, racing is a way of improving the breed for the street versions that are produced after the fact. And I remember when I was racing in England, when in modern race events, and in the 70s in Canada and up and down the west coast of California and Washington State, we were always tinkering with the bikes to make them go better. So a bike that was built on a certain date that is verified to have been ridden by a particular named rider may well have been a bike that really didn't handle very well, but it won a couple of races, and so it has that cachet, or that, as you said, provenance. And that's important to a lot of people. To me, I will do that for people like Dave, who really have helped me an awful lot. But I would prefer to build bikes that can be used and used extremely hard. And to, this is the roundabout way of answering your question. Well, yeah. How do I feel about David suddenly telling me, guess what? We feel that Colin Edwards is going to ride for Team USA, then Jason Pridmore, and then Jake Zemke. I got these in three separate emails from Dave. And I got more and more and more excited because these were the people that we needed to prove our chassis work.
Exactly.
And that's exactly what's happened.
They can push it. Now, David, I wanted to ask you because I started going to races in 1976, a lot later than what you did. But I sort of came up through the TZ era as an enthusiast, not as a racer. And there was something about the TZ350F. And anybody who says anything, or as soon as you start talking about TZ350Fs, someone will say, oh, but the frames used to break all the time. But they did, didn't they?
They did. And just for those history buffs who want to know a little bit about, not our competitor now, but someone else who has helped me in my frame building career, and that's the Harris brothers in the UK. They actually made their mark on their company name, building frames, in the early 70s when these TZ250, 350 Fs and Gs were breaking their frames right at the back of the engine mount.
Yes.
And they were breaking in half. Mm-hmm. And it was because the material that was used on those frames then wasn't really very good. And the back of the engine was mounted solidly into the frame, yet the front had rubber mounting. And with the harmonics and everything, the way the frame had been built, these frames were just breaking wholesale. And so what Yamaha Europe did was they approached the Harris brothers, who had just started building frames then, they commissioned them to build, I don't know whether it's 400 or 500 frames, that were identical replicas of the TZ350, 250 F frame in every way.
Existing weaknesses.
That solved all the weaknesses by building it out of better quality material, but that it would fit the original swing arm, original tank and everything else. And Harris did all that, and these are still out there. They were steel tube frames, Reynolds 531 bronze welded together. But at the end of the 70s, the Harris brothers said, well, we feel we can build a better frame than that, and they built a low boy frame. And Les Harris told me when I called him, as I was starting building frames again in 2006, how to find the rubber mounts that they used in their updated lowboy frame with the rear engine mount rubber mounted. And I found this rubber bushing. It was a silent rock bushing. And we reproduced an original frame. But even at that point in 2006, we knew that we had to reduce the steering head angle from the 27 degrees that was the way to do it in the 70s. We went straight to 25 and a half. And lengthen the wheelbase, because as you suck the forks back, you needed to lengthen the wheelbase, and made a very nice bike. We saw quite a lot of those in Australia, New Zealand, in Europe, and in the UK. And that was my first frame that I built in my era from selling my business in 76 to 2000. To 2006. 2005-06, starting building frames again as a hobby, and then having to incorporate a company in 2007. We've been running for now 11 years.
Well, I was actually fortunate that I got to interview the Harris brothers a couple of years ago, and I think I spent 40 minutes with them, and I could have spent a lot longer than
Absolutely.
That, because they were telling me all these fantastic stories of all this stuff that they did, and one of them would go, Lester would go such and such, and the other one would say, oh yes, but remember such and such, and it was just a hoot listening to them talk. But of course, in England at that time, there was this little cottage industry of bespoke frames, Maxton, Spondon, Barton Engineering in Wales and things like this. All these people had cut their teeth building specialist frames for the British singles bikes, and then they transferred that skill over into the Japanese bikes later on.
That's
so yeah, that tradition is a very old one.
The Harrises were in the right place at the right time, and obviously benefited from the work that they had put in, and then being given a large order for frames. I'm sure that they mentioned that, maybe they didn't mention that, but I feel fortunate that having had this accident racing and having worked with Yamaha Motor Canada and been over to Japan and seen and talked with the technicians, the designers, and seen the results by working in the field with people like Dealey Yamaha and future world champions like Steve Baker, I feel I was given a similar opportunity to use those skills, use that knowledge, when I, out of the blue, started a hobby business to start building frames again.
It was just one of these serendipitous sort of situations where everything just fell beautifully into place.
And by coming, being invited by the US team to come to Phillip Island, and then by some of the team New Zealand riders to come over and visit some of the shops in New Zealand this trip, it's something that I never dreamed in my whole imagination would come about. And now, of course, being here and seeing these three guys and the bikes go very, very well, and Marty Craggles, as we said earlier, has got first position in the four races on the latest spec CMR 2Z750. He feels he can go faster, so we'll have to see next year.
Dennis, thanks so much for talking to us. This was one interview that when I found out that you were here, this was one interview that I definitely wanted to do. And thank you for enjoying the heat and enduring the heat and burden of the day today, because it's been a pretty punishing day. But thank you for talking to us, because it's fascinating stuff. And I wish you well, of course, with CMR Racing Products. And the old saying is, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. Well, we're seeing the proof of the pudding that what you're doing is right.
Yes, I feel that my slice of the pie of that pudding is being eaten today. A lot sooner than I imagined it would ever be. And I thank you very much for hearing me out. I tend to speak a little too much, but you did ask the question, and I hope I answered all the answers.
Not at all. And I said to you off microphone that if you wanted to take 10 or 15 minutes to answer a question, then you go right ahead and do it. So no apology is necessary.
Very good.
Thank you, Dennis. Appreciate it. And all the best with CMR.
Thank you very much, and I will be back to Australia one of these days. I promise.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, it's Phil Hall back again. 25th annual Island Classic, the International Island Classic at Phillip Island, Bass Strait, Australia. And a pleasure to talk to Ralph Hudson from America, Team USA. Ralphie, we've sort of made it a tradition to chat every time you come out here, and there's always been something fascinating to talk about. But this particular one, I think we'll probably talk a little less about Phillip Island and a little bit more about Bolivia, if that's all right.
Oh, yes. It's the new story.
It is. It is the story of the year.
Yeah. Well,
so tell me what happened.
Well, there is the actual fastest streamlined motorcycle in the world is called the ACATAC. And I had heard that they were talking about going to Bolivia to the salt flats to try to break 400 miles an hour, because no one's done that yet. And so through the grapevine, I kind of figured out, well, who was going and who, to talk to. And I called and asked, could I possibly go along with my partially streamlined motorcycle? The record at that time was 262 miles per hour for the flying mile. And I had gone 266 at El Mirage Dry Lake, which is only 1.3 miles long. So I thought, I've got a really good chance of getting that. And so I made a call to Mike Akatiff, and he said that, sure, you'd be welcome to go along. So I started working on the bike. The FIM rules are a little bit different than the Bonneville rules for now, the Speed Week, and so I had to build a different tail section for it. So I had started on that, and about 2 weeks into it, I get another phone call, and they said, no, it's going to be a private event, only the Streamliner is going to go. So, you know, I was disappointed, but on the other hand, I was a little relieved, so, well, then I don't have to do all this work. And 2 weeks later, he called back and says, we're back on, you can go. But at that time, I thought, oh, great, now I've lost a month.
Yes.
You know, of real solid prep time. But built a new tail section for it and actually had a chance to run it at El Mirage. And I didn't set a record or anything, but it, you know, everything worked.
So is the tail section smaller or bigger?
It's smaller. There's more of the rear wheel showing. The rules say you have to show 135 degrees of rear wheel. The Bonneville SCTA rules, which is Southern California Timing Association, just say that you have to have a minimum of 4 inches ground clearance. And so it's not not quite the, you know, the same. And they also don't allow you to make the tail section as tall. It's about 6 inches. I can't remember what that is in centimeters, but...
I was brought up non-metric.
190. So. Anyway, so it was a little bit smaller tail, so I wasn't, you know, as happy about that, but everything else is good. So we found that customs is really difficult to do. Paperwork that's required is not so easy, and nobody seems to be able to tell you ahead of time what you need, and... So I was glad that we thought that we'd gotten the bike there 2 weeks before sailing because there were problems. Everything was wrong, and we had to redo this. And we couldn't ship couldn't ship compressed nitrogen with nitrous oxide, and they're almost the same thing. Both of them, you know, well, nitrogen is absolutely inert. Nitrous oxide is an oxidizer, but we couldn't ship them together. And so it's like, how to get them both down there? And we couldn't ship any liquid fuel with any compressed gases. Yeah, I guess that kind of makes sense. But at any rate, we finally got it all sorted with different people putting different things in other containers. And sent the container off, and you can watch online where it is, you know, on the ocean and everything. And anyway, they changed ships in Mexico, and I was nervous about that, but
yeah.
apparently it container got there, and it was supposed to be delivered a couple of days before we arrived, and we were arriving like 2 days early, trying to get acclimated to the elevation, which is 12,000 feet.
Rarified,
yeah. Yeah.
Hard pretty, to breathe. And...
Pretty thin. It was, and we get there, bikes are not there. It's tomorrow. The container comes tomorrow. Tomorrow comes and goes. Tomorrow. It's always tomorrow. And it's about 4 days later, it finally came on a Wednesday night, and the event was supposed to have started on Tuesday morning. So we'd lost, you know, 2 days, and then unpacked the bikes on Thursday morning. And what does every racer do as soon as they unpack their bike? You start it up. Well, I hadn't thought about this ahead of time, but at Bonneville, they don't want you, don't let you run antifreeze, because if you have a spill, it gets into the salt, it, you know, contaminates the groundwater eventually, I guess. So you have to run water. So I had drained it before I left, but I didn't put antifreeze in. I should have. So when I started the bike, there was apparently just, you know, a small amount of water left in the bottom of the water pump. It broke the water pump shaft. Immediately,
it was frozen.
It gets down to 20 degrees.
I've actually seen that happen.
Yeah, 20 degrees at night, 20 Fahrenheit, and 50 Fahrenheit high in the daytime. So it's pretty cold. It's wintertime there, and the only good thing about that is it's their dry season. You look online for the average rainfall, zero. So the salt flats were very dry, which was excellent. Bonneville is wet. You drive in it, you know, the salt sticks in your wheel wells and gets on the bottom of your boots before you get in your car. It's just kind of a mess. And it can't be good for traction, you know, because it is so wet. Bonneville is also bumpy right now. The salt is very thin. They say, I don't get to see it, but they say that the salt is at least 2 meters thick at in Bolivia. And it was just like white asphalt. It was really, really excellent. And so here we are, our first day.
Now, when you say we, did your bike come separately to the Accutac team, or did it come in the same container?
No, it's separate, which was good because the Accutac container was 2 days behind mine.
I remember.
There was another team who brought an Aprilia. It's an RS4. And they were running it on nitrous oxide, which is why we had to have it. And they ran it with the fairing first, and it went just over 200. But the record in that class is 223. They thought, I wonder how fast it'll go without the fairing. Because that record, I think, was like 192. And I'm sorry, that record is 189. And they decided to try for it, and they actually got it at 192, I believe. And so they were so happy because they thought that they were just going for the experience, be fun, but actually going to get an FIM record kind of put them over the moon. Yeah, it was great. And being a pretty stock bike, they had relatively little trouble. They probably made 20 runs. I think I made 5 the whole time. But the water pump shaft meant that we had to pull the clutch apart because the water pump shaft is part of the oil pump, and that's behind the clutch. So we had to pull all that apart and also had to take the oil pan off because the piece of shaft that broke had fallen down. Yeah, and you can't just trust that, oh, it won't go anywhere.
No.
Yeah, this would be famous last words probably. So that basically took the whole day. The next day, the Bolivian government put on a gala opening event, and they had the army there and the band, and they had a lot of politicians and set up a stage, and the president spoke, and a lot of other people did. And at that time, my bike was the only thing that looked like a race bike. And so they asked me to put it out front, and I was back in the container sorting things, I suppose. I go, the president's coming to look at your bike. Get over there. So I, I kind of trotted over and, met him at the bike. And he looked at me, and he actually was sort of like a little, he goes, El Viejo, which in Spanish means the old one.
Yes.
And, so he was expecting a much younger man.
A young tearaway.
Yes. And all I could think of was to point to my head and say, mucho cabeza, which is not true. But anyway, he was very warm and friendly and posed for photographs and his wife as well. And well, then he wanted to see it run. And so we started it up, and the bike takes off very slowly because it goes 140 miles an hour in low gear. But to make it a better show, I slipped the clutch out a ways and let it go and spun the tire and a little fishtail. But I think I actually damaged the clutch a little bit, or I hadn't adjusted it quite right after the water pump shaft change. And I wanted to go back and take the body off and all these things, but I got talked out of, no, we need to make a run. We need to show. Well, I burned the clutch up on my first run. Didn't even make it to the lights. Pull it back apart again. Fortunately, I had another clutch. But the put a new clutch in, started up, and no oil pressure. The clutch debris has clogged the oil filter. I have a 25 micron, which is pretty fine, remote filter. I don't use the stock one at all because the turbocharger is up there and there's no room. So we put on another filter, and it was so clogged that I got like 0 or maybe 5 pounds. So I shut it off, take it apart, and I own a second filter, but it didn't get in the box. So I had to clean the one we had, and this had happened once before, and even with compressed air and a solvent tank, I couldn't get it clean, but I had to. So it spent most of the evening in the hotel room with a toothbrush and hot water and WD-40 and slapping it on a piece of paper to see if I was getting more debris out of it. Finally got it clean, put it back in the bike, started up, has half the pressure it should have. Like, what could that be? And think, well, maybe it's the pickup filter, pickup screen. Sure enough, it's clogged. And it's also got like a some sort of a resin in it, it seems, something that maybe I changed oils and it made a compound that wouldn't come off. So tear the other engine apart again, take the oil pan off to get the pickup screen out of it, put that in, start it up, perfect. We make a run, and because at Bonneville, they give you 5 miles. And so I thought, well, I'll start 4 miles back from the lights, then I'll run a mile through the lights. Well, I was geared too low. The bike was up to top speed in 2 miles, which meant I had another 3 miles to run flat out.
Bouncing off a limiter.
Yeah, and the bike, well, the record was 262, and we were running 275, bouncing 274, 275. I go, well, it'll get me qualified for the record. I just have to go for it. But I see the engine temperature going up and up and up and up, and by the time the engine temp matched the speed, I said, I've got to shut it off. So I didn't get qualified. They did. I got into the lights, but I couldn't hold it to the end. It was just, I knew it would ruin the engine. So we had to go back, and with all that heat, it had actually melted a few hoses. The air filter was melted where it went onto the turbo, and so I was hoping that even though I shut it off, that I hadn't actually done real damage. And no way to fix it, and no way to really check. I did have a spare engine, but it wasn't as good an engine. But so we fix all of those things. It even it cracked two of the tires. It only has two. One blistered, and the other one, you know, is like a DOT tire, and they have just a little bit of tread in them. Well, it had cracked down in the bottom of the tread. I might not have noticed it, but there was an Australian land speed racer who had come to help, named Greg Waters, and he spotted it right away. I think he's seen it before. So, got to change the tires and, you know, kind of look everything over. No more runs that day. And the next day, have to make sure I get this all in the right order. We made a run, and it was 266. So it wasn't fast enough, really. And listening to the announcement.
Yeah.
So I look at the data on the computer, and the RPM line is not. Can we hold for a second?
Congratulations, man. That's great.
Excellent.
It's Eric Nielsen just finally got his FIM medical clearance through on a Sunday afternoon.
Amazing.
After sitting around twiddling his thumbs for the last 4 days.
Yes. So, anyway, so looking at the data on the computer, and the RPM line, which is normally about the thickness of a ballpoint pen line, is about 3/16, or, you know, like 4 millimeters thick. And I zoom in on it and see it's a very jiggly line there. And I wonder what that is. So I pack up the computer and borrow the SUV and drive back to the hotel, which is 11 miles away. Fortunately, it's right on the edge of the salt. But I get back there to get my computer guy to take a look at it. And unfortunately, it was a Sunday. He was home. I found him. And he looks at it and goes, oh, says, I think you've probably got a little whisker of metal stuck to the crank rotation sensor, and it's bouncing off the rotor on the end of the crankshaft. I go, brilliant. This guy is smart. So I drive back, and, you know, we pull the engine apart again. At least it's not so deep. But anyway, we pull it apart, get into that, and sure enough, there's a little whisker there. So we clean that all up really good.
That would have been debris from when the water pump let go?
Yeah, this is a water pump, or it might have been a transmission gear, you know, the way they clang together, it might have knocked a little chip off somewhere. And put it all back together, start it up, no difference. It's just as bad. So there's another sensor on the other bike, so other engine, so we pull that off, put it on, and it's better, but it has some other aberrations, some other little lines, just occasionally a spike up and then a spike up, down. So I drive back, call the computer guy, you know, email him the file, and he goes, I don't know what that is. So just run it. It might not make any difference. So, you know, it's like, okay, well, I'm happy I get to run it. And he doesn't go, no, do not run like that. He says, I don't know. He says, it might be fine. So I drive back, and out on the salt, we're remote enough that you can't get a cell, any cell coverage, no message, no phone calls. But you occasionally will get a text message, just like it floats on the breeze and catches you.
Text will get through and voice won't.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like if you try to send one, usually it's like, did not go. Yes. You have to keep trying, and occasionally it will. So at any rate, we've almost got the bike ready to run, and I get a text message, call me, I found something. But that means
you can't call
stopping.
Because there's no self.
Well, get back in the car, drive back to the hotel. So this is the third trip. So it's 66 miles of driving to make phone calls and text messages. So I drive him and he says, I looked back at the data from the last time we went to the dyno. And he said, the crank sensor, he says, we were keying off of the leading edge. And now, he says, for some reason, it's keying off the trailing edge. Did you change anything? I said, no. He says, well, and he tells me where to go into the computer and change a 1 to a 0. It's a pretty basic program, I guess. It's a Motec, Australian made. And but then at the very end of like the 5-minute explanation, because he says, or you could just swap the wires. I said, I'm more of a wire guy than a computer guy. So I go and with a little skinny, tiny screwdriver, I'm able to tease the connectors out without damaging anything, put them in offset, plug it in, and everything's perfect. Looks good again. But the sun is down. So we've lost another day. And so the next morning is Monday morning, last day of the event. So I go out and make a run. Doesn't go very fast. We come back in, think, what is wrong? What have we done? I'm looking at the data, and I can't see anything wrong. And there were a couple of Australians I mentioned who'd come up. Greg Waters and Jim Higgins have rented bikes in La Paz, Bolivia, and then ridden to the salt. And they would have been late, except the event was delayed by 3 days, so they were right on time. And so we're working, Greg and I are looking all over the bike, and Jim is kind of standing back and like having a cup of coffee or something. And he says, should that hose be connected to something? And there's a little hose hanging in back of the headers. I was like, yes. It had, in all the work on it, I had probably somehow pulled a hose off that goes from the turbocharger up to, there's a solenoid valve that controls the wastegate. The computer tells the solenoid valve open, close, you know, and so it was probably trying to give it more boost, and it just had nothing to close the wastegate with, so it didn't. And so we found that, put the bike all back together, which it sounds like it should be simple, but it kind of takes a long time. There's a lot of parts, there's hoses that don't fit, and it's all just a hassle. So we get it all back together, and there's another bike that has arrived in a crate. His container didn't make it, and there wasn't enough time, so he airmailed his bike down, and it got there the same day as the ACK attack did. So he'd had trouble with his, while I was working on the bike, he was able to make runs, and it wasn't going very fast. It was,
this is the bike from Texas.
Back from Texas, Al Lamb.
Yeah.
He's a Dallas Honda owner, and he's been land speed racing for 9-10 years. And he was the fastest sit-on bike in the world for about 5 years. And I kept thinking, I should be able to catch him, but it just didn't, you know. They say racing, it's all about the disappointment. But I was pretty sure we were capable. It just hadn't been able to happen. So he had been making runs that were down in round 200. And so I was heartened by that because I know I had gone 274. And then he did set the record at 266, which was better, but I thought, he's still within range. Well, he makes a run just before I was ready to go out at 285. And I go, woo, that's pretty fast.
That's raising the bar.
Yeah, quite a bit. So I made my run only 281. So I was feeling pretty sad up at the other end. You know, 4 miles an hour is a lot to find if you just don't have it. And this wasn't strategy, but, well, it was a little bit, but not for speed. It was getting late in the day, and I was worried about making my final run towards the sun. Because when the sun is right on the horizon, in Bolivia, it is blazingly bright. There's very little, if any, pollution up there. No ozone layer anymore. And no no cloud cover at all. And driving back to the pits the day before, I lost the road. You know, it was just a little grayer where the road is, and I lost it and looked around. It's just white in all directions. Well, at the end of our track is a volcano. So I saw the volcano and said, well, head for that. And I eventually did find the pits, which is good. So, but I didn't want to lose the track in the sun. And so,
not at that speed.
No, the people running the event recommend that you run toward the volcano, away from the pits, on your first run. Sorry, scratch that. They recommend you tow to the volcano and run toward the pits. You have 2 hours to make your second run. He says, if you need a tire, if you need anything that's at the pits, you'll be 4 miles away. If you run toward the volcano, you'll be 12 miles away. But I figured, you know, I've got everything in the car that I think we need, tires, fuel, tools. I'm going to run toward the volcano first and away from it on my second run, assuming the bike's still running for that. So I'm sitting up at the other end. I'm just not feeling very good about it. And so Al gets to make his second run before I make mine, and he only goes 272. My spirits brightened,
right, yes.
Because I figured he's left the door open for me, and there's a chance. But now it's pressure. Do not screw anything up. And a couple of times I've had things happen, like my knee blow out of the side of the bodywork from the air pressure coming in the front. And so I had to think about that. I had to think about my feet, that I wasn't like dragging my foot on the brake pedal. And that when I shifted, that I made sure that the shifter comes all the way back, you know, to catch the next gear and stay down, you know. So he makes his run up, and he's not real happy because it looks like now, you know, I have a chance, if I just run the same speed, of beating his average. So I take off, and I'm thinking of all the things. You know, it seems like so easy, just ride from here to there as fast as you can. But there's so many things you can screw up. There's a lot of mistakes to make still. And so I get into third gear, start squeezing my knees together, thinking, do not let and get lazy. Are your toes in? Wiggle my feet, make sure the toes are inside the bodywork. Get down. Can you get any lower and still see? You know, and I'm pushing up on the chin of my helmet to move the opening of the helmet up a little higher so I can get down lower. And everything's going well. I'm in sixth gear according to the dashboard, but I actually had that go wrong once, and I went through the lights in fifth, thinking I was in sixth. So I shifted again
just to be sure.
It still said six.
Yeah.
And so I'm driving down. I finally think everything's under control. I'm in the lights. I should glance over and see just how fast I'm going because there is a speed readout in the dashboard. There's a shadow right where I need to see from the sun behind me that I didn't want to be driving into. So at one level I thought, good decision not to go to the sun. And the
you can't see the
reservoir for the front brake is right there on the handlebar, kind of where they always are, and it's right where I would need to see. And the sun being so bright, the shadows are so dark. And it's like I started trying to move to see if I could look at it, and this said to myself, don't be stupid, just ride the bike.
Ride the bike.
You know, because
they'll tell you what speed you've done.
Yeah, I'll find out soon enough.
You can't go any faster anyway.
Yeah, yeah. And at 300 miles an hour, it would only take 12 seconds to do a mile. And it seems like an eternity with the engine just screaming at full revs. So there's some wind noise. The wind is pretty loud at that. I don't know how fast I'm going, but I'm hoping it's good. So I get done, second blue line, and it's the end of the lights. Just pull the clutch and let it coast at, you know, whatever speed I'm going for a couple of miles. We'd have trouble with the bike overheating like I did on my first run. I think that the very thin air doesn't draw the heat out of the radiator as well as it does at lower elevation. And I kind of don't care if it overheats now because I'm done.
Yep.
There's no more time to make another run anyway.
Yep.
And I'm coasting up, and I can see the pop-up tent where everybody's waiting, and there's the FIM officials are there. And we've been there together 9 days. Everybody's pretty friendly, and I think, you know, everybody kind of likes me. And I'm looking to see, is anybody celebrating? No. You know? And so my spirit kind of sinks again. I go, ooh, maybe it's not good. Well, I got within, maybe 100 feet, 50 meters, and they start waving and jumping around. It's like,
yes.
You know, so I pull up, and there's a woman who's a land speed racer who just came down to watch and wants to see what it's like, I think, because I think she wants to go back down, named Erin Sills. And so I pull up next to her, and I was like, what's my speed? And just calm as can be, she says into her radio, would you repeat the speed for bike 35-35? And holds it up to my helmet, and I hear the 289 point. I didn't even listen to the thousands.
It was just, points.
Yahoo! We got it! We got it! And that was me. I got my Hollywood ending. I really was not convinced it was going to happen. And then it was interesting, I learned later from the Aprilia guys who had made 20 runs. They said, oh yeah. He says, we always go 3 or 4 miles an hour faster toward the pits than toward the volcano. So Al had gone the fast. He had gone the downhill way first.
He'd gone the fast
to do 285.
His way back was slower.
The slow way, and I did it the other way. I went the slow way first and the fast way back.
289.
And I got the 289. Well, I also backed up another half a mile to get a better run at it because I was looking at the speed, and I wasn't quite to top speed when I hit the lights. I accelerated through them a little bit. So I thought that would help, and the fact that it was the downhill way, even though I'm sure it's absolutely dead flat. Maybe there's just a little breeze that we couldn't feel or something. So that was a pretty happy day, and Al was such a good sportsman. You know, he came over and congratulated me, and, you know, I had pictures taken, you know, raising my hand, the winner. And but he did say, he says, I'm coming back to beat you. And I had to say, well, you know, I'm going to go faster next time.
and he did, he did treat you very well in the documentary that he filmed that was supposed to be about his achievement.
Yes.
But he gave you all the credit, you know, for how you had done as well, which I thought was very cool.
It really was. I mean, to be accurate, they needed to do that. But I thought the way they did it was really very nice, you know. And so we're friendly competitors. It's been published that I loaned him a part he needed to get the record, but that's not true. I would, but I didn't have it. He needed another turbocharger controller, the solenoid, and I didn't have a spare. But it got me thinking, I'd better buy one.
So, Ralph, it's been a roller coaster since then. News items on the local TV at home in America, FIM World Champions dinner at in Spain, sitting down with world champion Marquez and so forth. Do you pinch yourself sometimes and wonder, how did all this happen?
Well, yeah, I think because you would have expected it should have been someone who has a big bike shop, a bike building operation, or somebody who's been doing it even longer than I have. So I feel pretty lucky, I'm still just a guy who goes and works out in the shop just about every night at the expense of any social life. But I feel fortunate that, there are probably things I've done that I don't even know were right. And there were probably some mistakes that I think were a great idea. But the whole project, it has been successful from the first outing, which makes me feel really good because this is an idea that I came up with based on the NSU team. They came back in 1957 and 58, and they went really fast with small engines.
Yeah.
And in looking at them, they look like airplane fuselages.
Teardrop.
Yeah, with no wings. And the rules won't allow you to do that anymore. They've decided it was dangerous. But they put their feet down through the bottom, and they just sat down in the top and sealed it off, and now you've got to have a roll cage and fire suppression and firewalls and ankle and wrist restraints and all these things that aren't any fun. I kind of like doing this on what kind of looks like a regular motorcycle. You can relate to it. The streamliners look like Nike missiles or something. It's amazing for me to be at a race like this where there's so many world-class riders, and even though I can't beat them on the track, to look at it and say, I've ridden faster than every one of these guys in a straight line.
Down with Mark Marquez, and you're faster than Mark Marquez.
Yeah. I couldn't engage him in conversation. I think it was the end of an autograph session. I think he was just tired and didn't want to get into it, but... So that was too bad, but I did get my picture with him, so he was very gracious that way.
Now, the Island Classic, just shifting gears quickly back, because you're going to be needed soon.
Yeah.
You're still having fun riding the TD2 and still getting your ears boxed by Murray Seabrook all the time, which must be incredibly frustrating. But, you're the best of the rest by a long, long way in the class that you're racing. And then Jason, of course, racing your big bike. The last 3 years you've said, I really wish that I could see what the true potential of this bike is. Well, now you're finding out what the potential of it is.
Yeah, which again is pretty amazing. Jason Pridmore, we think, is probably a little underrated. I don't think anybody expected him to do this. But he was actually fastest lap in the first race, and second, he was only missed fastest lap by 2/1000ths of a second in the second.
That's right.
Even though he finished fourth both times, he's seventh on the grid, which is a little disadvantage. But I just can't say enough about how well he's doing, and he's very, very grateful, he says, to be riding the bike, and feel pretty happy that it hasn't broken or fallen apart, and I can't take all the credit for that. He had the bike gone over by Benny Solis Sr. His son Benny Solis Jr. is a very fast young rider in the American circuit. The engine was built by Vicious Cycles, Joe Patu, and he's obviously done a very nice job as well.
Motorcycle racing is a vicious cycle.
Yes, it's a great name for a shop.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah, he's a very, very clever guy.
Sort of thing you wish you'd thought of.
Yes, and then had a shop to call that. But it is, it's funny, like Jason was saying, how does it feel to see your bike going around? I said, I don't really think about it that way. I just think about it, my friend Jason, on the American team is doing so well.
I was standing in the British pit watching, in Team GB pit, watching the live feed, because they've got a great big screen there.
Yeah.
And they're all going, of course they know Jason because he's raced in BSB and World Endurance. They know him really well anyway. And they're all going, wow, look at how Jason's going. And I said to the guy standing next to me, I said, you know who built the bike that he's riding, don't you? And they went, no. I said, the fastest motorcyclist in the world, that's who. And they went, ah.
Well, I have to say I was very humbled, I guess. Maybe yesterday I got to sit down with somebody who's talking with Jeremy Burgess, and he knew the story. He didn't know who I was. He goes, oh, yeah, I've read about that. And I was just surprised because you kind of feel like it's such a small niche in the motorcycle world that not too many people really know.
Well, you do realize that I'm making it my business to make you famous, don't you?
Excellent.
You do realize that, don't
okay.
you?
Okay. And when do we work on Rich?
Well, that's
that come after
to be,
famous?
That's proving to be a little more difficult.
I know. Yeah, I don't actually, if anybody wants to sponsor, I don't really have any sponsors. That's all self-sponsored, and Al has Honda behind him, but still, it's really, it's very satisfying.
If you had a sponsor, they'd probably meddle and tell you how to do your job, and it wouldn't go as well as what it goes now.
Possibly. I know, I think that's some of the problem with some of the big streamliner projects that are, everybody's trying to beat the ACK Attack, which is the bike that went to Bolivia. And they haven't done it yet. We'll see. There's somebody that I was actually rooting for was Sam Wheeler, but he died in his streamliner up at Bonneville probably a year and a half ago now. So he was my first choice. But now that he's gone, I'd say the ACK Attack is my favorite rider. Although I like Guy Martin, so we'll see.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, yeah. It's hard not to like Guy Martin.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There is a video that I saw. I just loved his attitude. He's riding the Triumph Streamliner, and it gets into this big wobble. And it steers with handles, not handlebars. And he braces them with his knees and gets it back into control where it looked for sure it was going to go down. And the camera started, when he gets down, they open the container, and he says, you've got to do something about that. Where you would expect somebody to go, I am not riding this again. That was, I could have died. He was like, you've got to do something about that.
Well, I always think that the classic one is the On Any Sunday with Cal Raborn with the...
Oh, yeah.
And he keeps, they keep bringing him back, and they cut the helmet visor off, and he still can't see any, and he keeps saying to them, you guys are crazy. You guys are crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, they had never. He fit in the streamliner. They had never put a helmet on him.
No, that's
talk
right.
About
he fit in.
The simple things.
Yes, yes.
And what I understand is that once he got going, he couldn't see straight ahead.
No, he had to look sideways.
He had to look sideways and watch the cones at the side of the course. They also have mile numbers, so he knew where he was. But to be able to, and there, I would think, I've never driven one, but I would think they're a little weird to balance because you can't use your body English at all. You just, if it starts to lean one way, you have to turn that direction to pick up the balance, you know.
Well, they said up to a certain speed to turn right, you turn the handlebars right.
Yeah.
From that certain speed to that certain speed, if you want to go right, you've got to turn the handlebars left. And then when you get above that certain speed, then you've got to turn the handlebars right again.
Yeah.
There's a little counter-steering, obviously, because of aerodynamics and everything.
Well,
but yeah, you guys are crazy. Guys are crazy.
Well,
I'll never forget that.
Yeah, yeah. That was a Don Vesco myth. And I've talked to people riding, they're going, no. It always steers the same.
So
I think Bill
Brown taking some poetic license.
Well, no, that was, people used to say that, but, you know, I talked to Sam Wheeler, you know, and asked him about that. He goes, no. He says it steers the same way the whole time, which makes sense because once it's leaning in a direction to pick up the balance, you need to steer underneath it to right the bike, you know, kind of like you do, like even a lot of, you know, you counter steer a motorcycle to tip it into a corner, you know. And he says it's the same. And I asked him, was it hard to learn how to ride? And he goes, well, I didn't know it was supposed to be. So I just went out and rode it. He built one in like 1973 with a Bull Taco.
The keep it simple principle.
Yeah, he didn't know it was supposed to be hard. So it's like, okay, let's go ride.
And in some respects, I think that's sort of pretty much an example of the way what you've done is, you know, you haven't taken any notice of what anybody said you couldn't. Could do and couldn't do and should do and shouldn't do. You've just steered your own path and, you know, this is what I think we should do, and you've done it.
Yeah, it's it's been amazing. You know, it's so satisfying when you think you have a good idea and it actually works. Because life is so full of lessons that you learn from mistakes.
Ralph, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Always one of the reasons why I love the Island Classic most is I get a chance to sit down and talk with you again. And I have told you this off microphone, so I'm not saying this just to be heard, but you know that you are my hero, don't you?
Oh.
And I really, you know, it's just such a joy to keep in contact with you. The Bolivia thing was such a hoot.
Yeah.
I couldn't wait for you to get down here so I could sit down and get you to tell me the story from the horse's mouth instead, and it's just been fantastic.
Very good. So
grateful for you spending the time. Yeah. I better let you go because you've got a race coming up soon.
Two races from now. So,
Ralph, thank you so much for your time.
Appreciate it. Phil.
Catch you, mate.
It's always a pleasure.
Okay, we're back at Phillip Island. Well, we're actually not back at Phillip Island. We haven't left. But talking to Team USA's Jake Zemke. It's the 25th anniversary of the International Island Classic. And, Jake, your first visit here. And I guess the first thing I need to say is, yeah, what are your first impressions?
Phillip Island's amazing. It's the racetrack. We'll start with that part of it. It was one of those tracks throughout my career when I was racing, I always looked at and went, man, if I could just get down to Phillip Island, like, that looks like my kind of track, my kind of place. And just with the fast, sweeping corners, it looked amazing. And obviously the backdrop, the setting with it being right on the ocean. And I always wanted to get down here, you know. And when the opportunity came for me to get down here, I jumped at it. And Dave and Lorraine Crissell, they, you know, supplied a bike for me to get down here and come down to the race. And, you know, I came down with Jason Pridmore and a bunch of his friends. They came down early, and he's got about, I don't know, 12 or 15 or 16 people with him. So we all did the track day on Monday, Tuesday, leading up to the event, which was great to get a little track time in before we got here and, you know, figure out which way it goes. And yeah, the whole experience has been great. You know, all the people in Australia have been nothing but accommodating and wonderful, and man, it's just it's a great place.
So, Jake, for the benefit of our readers who...
Well, there's always that, you know. That's part of the Phillip Island Classic right there, you know. If you don't wear your earplugs, you might hurt your ears.
That's right, yeah. And, of course, you had to get a Ducati that pulled up right outside the door out here. You know, Imbler exhaust and dry clutch rattling. So, Jake, what's the Jake Zemke story for the benefit of those of us who don't follow American racing closely?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, as a kid, I grew up racing flat track and dirt track and... you know, did that until I was 17, was a professional doing that, and grew up racing with on the West Coast with the Bostrom brothers and the Waits and a good buddy, Johnny Murphy. And, you know, that turned into meeting the Haydens at the Amateur Nationals, and we became really good friends with them. And, you know, we all kind of made our way, most of us outside of Johnny, all made our way into road racing. And, you know, I had a great career. I raced professionally from 97 to 2014, and, you know, it was a long career. It was good. You know, road racing was great to me. I'm healthy, like that fact, and, you know, came away with some wins, some championships, some podiums, Daytona 200, just a lot of different stuff. And, you know, racing's really been cool. It's taken me all over the world, and you know, even in retirement, apparently it still is.
Unfortunately, you sort of happened to be there when the AMA probably sort of started to tail off a little bit.
Yeah.
The glory days of Mladen and all those guys who you would have seen race when you were a young man.
Yeah, I had lots of races with those guys, and, you know, we're right in the thick of things when if you want to call them the glory days, when things were really good in America, for sure. You know, we're shooting those years, finishing my first rookie year in Superbike was 04, and I think I finished third in the championship to Mladen and got some wins, and we had really good equipment that year. And the following year, Honda decided instead of purchasing HRC equipment, they just build them in-house in America, and it was a building process for sure. But you know, it was there was good times back then, and definitely lived through what they call the glory days there, and you know, and saw it out the other side, and it's good to see it rebuilding now with Wayne Rainey and the whole crew down there at Moto America. They've been doing a great job at rebuilding the series, and you know, hopefully we'll see it get back to that point again.
Yeah, I think we all do that because I think all of us, and I mean I'm talking about myself here now, because I remember American racing. I mean they used to broadcast the AMA Superbike races here in Australia.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'd be up there rooting for Maladen and Miguel G. Hamill and all these guys, but we knew them nearly as well as we knew our own races. Yeah, that's how important it was. And I think, you know, we're probably just maybe not as pretty much as disappointed as you guys were at the way things went. But, you know, everyone, all the reports I'm getting, everybody's, what I'm reading, what people are saying is that Rainey and his crew are really on the right track, and they're dedicated to rebuilding American racing to the way, you know, back to the way it used to be.
Yeah, they're doing a great job, and you know, I'm still at all the races, even though I'm retired from racing. I work for a management company, and I manage Cam Beaubier and JD Beach, and those guys are, you know, it's good to see some life coming back into the series there. You know, I guess 2014 was probably the worst year. We were down to six rounds that year, and no TV coverage, and that's when Wayne stepped in, and starting in 2015, and it's really turned it around in a short amount of time.
And it really needed someone with that sort of credibility, with that sort of profile, to be able to take it by the throat and say, right, you know, this is the way it's going to be. This is my plan, this is my vision, and we're going to follow it through.
Yeah, it's like I said, it's great to see Wayne, you know, all his partners. He's got three partners in the deal, and all four of them are really committed to the series and seeing it through and making sure it works, and, you know, getting some Americans back into the World Championship.
That's a really important thing, because you know, Lawson and, you know, Roberts, Mamola, and, you know, all those guys, that's what I remember as a young man, you know, and I think to myself, when are we going to get an American in MotoGP again?
Yeah, you know, it's well, hopefully sooner than later, but yeah, there's still a lot of talent there. I think part of it is, you know, as you said, you guys used to see the American stuff on TV, and, you know, when it kind of disappeared from an international scene, and we started not having, you know, the top riders there anymore, I think it kind of fell out of people's sight, and once you're out of sight, you're out of mind, and they just go, oh, well, you know, America, this, that, but, you know, I truly believe you take the top guys in America and you pluck them into other series, they're going to do just fine.
Sure, absolutely. And, of course, the other problem is that there's so much other sport out there. There's so much other motorsport. There's so much other motorcycle sport, Supercross and things like that. If you drop your game, some other promoter is going to come in and snatch up your audience.
Yeah, it's a little tough in America just because the country's so big and spread out. And, you know, when I went to England over to British Superbikes, they, you know, the country's probably a third of the size of just California.
Yes.
So I remember, you know, every racetrack I went to, we weren't further than 4 hour drives, and you know, in the U, and so you would see a lot of the same fan base at the races. They have great turnouts, great crowds, put on a good series, and you know, they do quite well, and but you see a lot of the same faces at the races, you know, and which is great. But you can't do that in America. You know, it's very rare to see the same. You see the same people year after year, but you don't see them at all the different tracks. You just see them at one or two if they're close enough. But yeah, you know, the American Series, it still has a ways to go as far as getting all the manufacturers back involved. And, you know, there's actually a lot more good riders that a lot of people have never heard about in America. It's just they don't have, you know, proper equipment under them, proper teams behind them yet. So, you know, hopefully that'll turn around sooner than later.
I've heard of Cam Beaubier, of course. He's getting quite a good profile, and some big raps on Jake Gagne as well.
Yeah, for sure. Two extremely talented kids out of the U.S. You know, it's great to see Jake get the opportunity to go over to World Superbike, and, you know, Cam's gotten to go do We got to fill in at Donington Park back in 2016, and definitely has, I would say, aspirations to get back to Europe. You know, he cut his teeth there in the Red Bull MotoGP Rookies Cup and on into the CEV Championship, which then led him into the 125 World Championship. And, I think he definitely, not just him, there's a lot of young Americans that want to go that route. Not just Americans, too. You know, we've got some fast kids from other countries as well. It seems like we're getting more and more guys. Obviously, Tony Elias coming over from Spain, and then we've got Matthew Schultz, who's South African, as well as Cam Peterson, who's South African. His dad was Robbie Peterson. We're getting to the point where we're getting a lot more guys internationally that keep inquiring about our series. I know Ant West came and did a few rounds last year and was very, very interested in the series, and as well as we had Claudio Corti on the Aprilia couple years back, 2 years ago. And so yeah, it's cool to see a lot of interest from the other nations. I think they're all kind of waiting for it, because in those glory days of the U.S. like, there was a lot of Australians, as you know. It was like their second home, it seemed like. And guys like Neil Hodgson, I remember Ducati bringing all kinds of Europeans over and filling seats from time to time. And, like I said, I hope we can get back to that spot again.
So, Jake, are you a generational racer? Did your dad race, or your granddad? Or?
Yeah, my dad got involved in racing a little bit, but he was just, I don't even think he started until he was in his 30s. And he started racing amateur flat track races and not too long after that was when I was born, so I kind of grew up just being around the racetrack, and even from being a baby. And yeah, pretty much. There's pictures of me. I'm not even walking yet in a motorcycle race. So, that's definitely what led me into it, and the support of my family, and my mom and dad, and my sister through the years. Would have been impossible without him. So, that was awesome. And now, I've got my own family and my wife and kids. And, even during a large portion of my racing career. So, I think me and my wife have been together since like 2003 or 4. So, they were around for a good chunk of it and always supportive, and obviously still are. My wife's like, the opportunity came up. I told her about it, and she's like, yeah, get out of here, go down there. And tried to drag her down here with me, but, after maybe next year.
See, I've always been of the opinion that one of the things that made the American riders great and the Australian riders great was the fact that they did have that dirt track background.
Yeah, definitely. Being a kid growing up, all those great road racers, that America was producing all came from dirt track, whether it was Kenny Roberts, Mamola, Lawson, Rainey, you just keep going through the list, and Doug Chandler was another great, that raced in the Grand Prix. Like most all those guys that the world got to experience all came from dirt track, and it was a great proving ground. And it was pretty obvious when, after Kenny had retired, when the Spanish Motorcycle Federation had him, basically build a dirt track training facility in Spain. And I think, in today's world, you kind of see the benefit of that. It's getting kids on bikes at a young age, and getting those riding skills is super important. And, I think there was a little bit of a change of the tide for a short time. And, mini motos came along, and kids riding on go-kart tracks and mini bikes, road racing them. And so then I think you had definitely some definite, I guess you would call them more pure road racers that grew up from a young age on the asphalt. Yeah, you're talking about guys like Rossi and Lorenzo, and there's a whole generation there. But even with that, you see where Rossi's gone now. It's gone back to dirt track, and they see the value of the training and the training tool it is. Marquez, it's flat track's on a big resurgence in America right now, and worldwide. I think there's just been a lot of attention brought to it, and which I think is a great thing. You can't. Dirt track really prepares you to ride a high-level road race bike. The bike's moving around a lot. It's sliding. It's learning throttle control. Like I said, bike skills, and the nice thing about dirt track, especially like Collins Boot Camp, for example, you know, done on TTR 125s, you know, you get out there on the mini bikes, and it's, I'm not going to say it's, you can't get hurt, but, you know, you can bang around with your buddies quite a bit and bang bars and run into each other, and usually you don't get too banged up doing it, so it's a good time, and I think it's great that dirt track is where it's at, and you know, hopefully it can continue to build on that success.
And the other thing about that, of course, is it teaches you how to get the most out of an underpowered bike.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I mean, I think that's a lot of it, but I also, like I said, I think the biggest part of it is just getting kids on bikes at a young age, you know, and they learn so much, and to where the riding motorcycles just becomes natural to them, and they don't really think about it, they just go do it, and I think that that plays a big role in them being able to be successful. And especially when you look at, you know, if you're looking at Grand Prix racing anymore, I mean, you look at the Moto 3 class and you've got kids, you know, 14, 15 years old out there, and you know, already in a world championship at that young of an age. So you definitely have to be prepared for that, and you know, whether it's you know, the mini moto type stuff, or the mini bike road racing, or if it's flat track. I think that you know, having those kids on those bikes early is extremely critical if there's aspirations to go on and be a world champion.
You can't afford to start when you're 20.
No, not when Mark has had, what, like probably 5 championships by the time he was 20. I mean, you know, you just can't. You can't start that late. Well, I shouldn't say that. Yes, you can definitely start that late. I mean, especially there, just not to be, I think, into MotoGP. You know, you look at World Superbike, and we've had champions in their 40s. You know, you look at, obviously, your Troy Bayliss is the guy, right? But then we also had Biaggi, you had Checa. You've had multiple guys that were 40 years old.
Into their 40s.
Yeah, that were winning the world championship in Superbikes in their 40s. So, you know, I think you'll probably see Bayliss win an Australian Superbike Championship in his mid-40s here real quick. So, you know, it's cool. I think that I think there's something for everyone. And even a guy like Josh Hayes, with, you know, how successful he was, he never even got on a road race bike until he was 21 years old, you know. And you look at an American champion who's you know, very decorated and you know, has a lot of wins in the history book, and it gives them old guys a little bit of hope.
So Jake, just based on what you've experienced already, do you see yourself coming back here for the Island Classic next year?
Yeah, I could definitely fancy a go. You know, I've had a bit of bike trouble so far, and I've spent a lot more time working on the bike than riding it. You know, if I was to come back again another time, I'd be a little bit more prepared. I think, you know, you look at some of the efforts put on by the other teams, and you know, they've got proper mechanics and things like that, and I'm over here working on the bike pretty much by myself, so that takes a little bit of the fun out of it, but I'm still enjoying the heck out of it, and love Phillip Island, and you know, outside of that 15-hour plane flight, it's great.
Absolutely. And look, I think one of the problems is the fact that historic racing in America isn't like historic racing here. It is an amateur sport, racing bikes that were the historic bikes in the period. And this isn't. This is sort of getting up to the stage where it's sort of a semi-professional thing. And if you want to be successful, you have to approach it from that point of view.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if you look at the class we're all racing in, you know, we're all a bunch of ex-racers, all from a pretty high level, and you know, respectively, depending on what series or whatever. But I mean, you've got you know, guys like Colin and Troy and McWilliams. I mean, these guys all raced at the highest level of racing, and you know, but even just beyond those guys, all the guys behind them are all, you know, in domestic championships or the world championships, and you can't count any of them out. I mean, I've known and raced with quite a few of them over the years, whether, you know, it was just a one-off deal here or there, whether it was in World Superbike or World Endurance or, you know, in BSB where I've traveled around a little bit. But, you know, what a great race. And I think, you know, one of the biggest things for me is everybody back home is like, is this thing televised? Like, is it live streaming? Like, how can we watch it? You know, and that's been the biggest question. And honestly, I haven't even asked anybody here. I have no idea. I know there's some live timing going on.
That'll be it.
Yeah, so you know.
Because unfortunately, our sport here is the same, has the same problem. It is a very low profile, flying under the radar.
Yeah, for sure,
Fanatically followed by its enthusiasts, but outside of the general.
Yeah.
I mean, you watched the television news last night in Melbourne, there wasn't a word about it. This is virtually a world championship event taking place within a spitting distance of Melbourne, and nothing on the television news about it at all.
Yeah, you know, it's motorcycles a tough sale in most countries, and especially when they're not used as a mode of transportation, so people don't really relate to them or can't understand them. And,
would you be tempted to go back and do some historic racing in the States?
You know what? I mean, I've gone to Barber Vintage Festival the last 3 years in a row in 15, 16, 17 and raced down there. And I was there in 13 as a guest of Triumph and checked it out. And, but at Barber, I'm not actually racing a vintage bike. They've got some more modern classes for Twins
that's
and Ducatis.
Right, yes.
So,
that's
you know, I've
right.
had the pleasure to ride an ex-World Superbike 1098 Ducati. And the last couple of years, I've been on a Pirabon X80R that's been just amazing, put together by Brian Sharp at Boulder Motorsports. And that bike was just such a pleasure to ride. The first year we rode it with an 848 motor in it, and then this last year we rode it with a 1098 with a full-blown superbike motor. So still get to kick around and have a little bit of fun. And obviously the folks at Arma, you know, I think they are doing a good job. And, you know, one thing that really brought out a lot of even current professionals this year to the Barber event was, you know, they actually had they put on a pro race or a semi-pro race that they put up a purse. And, you know, there was quite a few guys that came out of the woodwork for that. We had, you know, Jeff May, Taylor Knapp, both, you know, current Moto America guys. And Jeff obviously had some World Superbike experience. And Danny Eslick, multi-time Daytona 200 champion, multi-time national champion. Yeah, Michael Barnes, another Daytona 200 champion. Myself. There was. I know I'm forgetting some guys. Jason DeSalvo, another perennial front runner in AMA stuff. And so the stakes were definitely amped up, and I think you'll see even more guys out there next year. And, you know, ARMA's committing to, at last I heard anyways, to continue, you know, putting on that one race during the weekend for us guys that are still kind of not quite ready to give it up.
Excellent. Well, you know, it never hurts to keep your hand, you know. I spent quite a while talking to Bruce Lind over there. He's celebrating his 55th year of road racing at the moment.
Yeah, pretty amazing, amazing.
On a bike that's over 40 years old and has been sitting in his shed for 30 years without being raced at all. So
yeah, I think Bruce is 70 years old, man. It's such a cool thing to see, you know, the joy and the excitement in his face, you know, spinning some laps around Phillip Island. It's a special circuit, and you know, at home we don't have anything like it. We have some fast tracks, very fast tracks, but here at Phillip Island, I mean, we've got fourth and fifth gear corners, where in America everything's pretty much second and third. We might have some fast straightaways, but usually got to stop when you get to the end.
Yeah, because this isn't a modern circuit.
No.
This isn't the stop-start circuit. This circuit, in its in this design, goes back to the 60s.
Yeah, I know. It's incredible, right? Like, today everything's computer-generated and drawn up, and you know, they 3D model it. I don't know what in the heck they do, but they make these racetracks. And, you know, the best ones are ones like this, where the guy just got in his tractor and he drove around a field and said, hey, yeah, this looks like a good spot.
Drew it out with a stick in the dirt.
Exactly.
Said, roughly, that'll do.
Yeah, exactly. So, it's pretty darn cool that, you know, this track's been preserved in its original form like that, and it hasn't had to change. It's cool to see that there's so much room here that, you know, if they have to expand runoff areas and things like that to catch up with the times and the speeds, like this track, it's great because they have that space. I know a lot of tracks in America, unfortunately, when they got the land and built them years and years ago,
they thought this is all we'll need.
Exactly. So they're built right on the property line, so they can't expand anymore and make bigger gravel traps and things. So, yeah. Yeah, it's pretty cool. And Phillip Island, like I said, you just can't stop smiling when you come to this place.
I've noticed. Jake, thank you so much for your time. You've been very generous with your time. I know you're busy. And hopefully this is a chance for you to sort of de-stress a little bit and stop worrying about that. It's been great hearing your story, and hope you have a great rest of the weekend, and I'd love to see you back here in 2019.
Yeah, I think it's the competitor coming out in me, you know. I mean, most of the guys are just happy to be down here riding, and I'm looking at this thing going, man,
I hate to lose.
Yeah, and I've been working on this bike thrash, and I've had the carburetors off it about 8 times already, changing jetting and things like that, and it's like, and I'm no mechanic, believe me. it's quite funny, but like I said, that takes a little bit of the fun out of it, but the fun out of it at this point, it's starting to get a little more serious because we're all racers, and so it's like we want to all go to the front. And we'll give it our best shot though, and hopefully this is just a building year to where we can build on to keep coming back in the future.
Jake, thank you so much for your time, and I'd certainly love to see you back. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Bye bye.